Good morning. It's the KBOO News for Thursday, November 9th, 2006. We're dedicating today's broadcast to the people in the Middle East who are working tirelessly for peace. Alhamdulillah. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Brian Smith. An Oregon family defeated the efforts of New Yorker Howard Rich to load the elections dice with campaign contribution money.
And Cindy Sheehan was arrested in Washington, D.C. And Hamas militants are vowing to avenge the massacre in Beit Hanun last week.
And Portland area weather calls for a chance of showers this morning, then showers likely in the afternoon with a slight chance of thunder showers, highs 50 to 55. And tonight's mostly cloudy, slight chance of showers and rain likely in the after midnight, lows in the 40s. And 69% of Oregon's registered voters cast ballots in this year's election, according to preliminary figures kept by the Secretary of State's office. The number is expected to inch up as final numbers come in and glitches are accounted for, like ballots mailed from one county that have yet to reach another. Secretary of State Bill Bradbury is sticking by his 71% turnout prediction. And by yesterday afternoon, about a tenth of Oregon's votes remained to be counted, mostly in populous Multnomah and Washington counties. The votes were critical in Multnomah County, where Republican Speaker Karen Minnis of Wood Village and Democratic challenger Rob Brading were in a battle. With 73% of the vote counted as of last night, Minnis had a lead of about 400 votes over Brading.
One election subplot across the nation was a campaign led by New York City real estate investor Howard Rich to promote ballot measures in numerous states seeking to rein in state and local government. Of nine Rich-supported measures, only one succeeded, a property rights measure in Arizona that would require state and local authorities to compensate property owners if land use regulations lower the value of their property. Similar measures lost in California, Idaho, and Washington. While Oregon and Colorado rejected term limits bills, and in Oregon it was Measure 45. Maine, Nebraska, and Oregon, Measure 48, rejected proposals to cap state spending. Rich poured over $12 million into anti-government races and measures during this campaign season. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Oregon voters decided this week that nearly all Oregonians should have access to prescription drug discounts. And by opening that door, some health care experts say, voters have created a ripe opportunity for further health care reforms in the 2007 legislative session. Ballot Measure 44 expands eligibility for a drug purchasing pool, which was initially designed as a discount program for low-income seniors. Now that the measure has passed, any Oregon resident without prescription drug coverage can soon enroll in the program. The larger the pool gets, the better the leveraging power and potentially the lower cost of the drugs. The pool has about 4,000 members, but the state expects enrollment could expand to 400,000. Some healthcare advocacy groups estimate the pool could grow to 1 million members. The measure got the support of more than 77% of voters on Tuesday and had no registered opponents. It was the only health care measure on the ballot, and some health care leaders say the overwhelming support bodes well for more attention to be paid to health care during the legislative session.
Beginning Friday, moviegoers at 23 Portland area Regal Cinema Theaters will see that critical health message delivered in a decidedly uncommon manner. The idea is that a cinema ad which plays to a captive audience will increase knowledge about the dangers of using antibiotics when you don't need them. Overuse of antibiotics, particularly for viral conditions that they can't help, has led to an increase in bacteria that are dangerously resistant to the drugs and extraordinarily difficult to treat. Nationally, more than half of Staphylococci aureus cases are resistant to antibiotics. Last year in the Portland area, more than 300 patients were hospitalized with drug-resistant staph infections, and 17% of the strep pneumonia cases were resistant to antibiotics as well. Oregon doctors write thousands of unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions each year, often under heavy pressure from ill-informed patients. In 2002, Oregon's Department of Human Services began asking residents whether they knew of the trouble that inappropriate antibiotic use causes. 76% did not. The past two winters, the campaign has placed ads on MAX trains and TriMet buses. Awareness has risen a bit, but health officials say it's got a long way to go. This from the Oregonian.
and also from the Oregonian in Gresham. After locking up the support of key civic and business leaders during his campaign, City Councilor Shane Bemis appeared to be locking up the mayor's seat with a commanding show at the polls. Incumbent Chuck Becker had urged voters to return him to office for a third four-year term, but in the early vote count, 58% had thrown their support to Council President Bemis, who branded Becker's leadership inconsistent on all vital issues to Oregon's fourth largest city: public safety, livability, and managed growth. Numbers were strong enough at times that Bemis declared victory.
The incorporation of Bull Mountain appeared to be failing in incomplete returns yesterday, but the early tally, still fewer than 400 votes, showed a close race that could change with only a few dozen ballots. The partial returns showed a vote of 55% against, 45 in favor. The incorporation measure was designed to form a new city of Bull Mountain with about 8,100 residents on nearly 1,100 acres of land west of Tigard. If successful, the city would be the county's first since 1966, when King City and Durham were incorporated. One Bull Mountain resident said that she felt it was the area's last best chance to preserve wildlands and parks areas on the mountain. This from the Oregonian and other sources.
Washington voters went green Tuesday, approving an initiative to require utility companies to conserve energy and fending off another that would limit land use regulations intended to control development. The battle over I-933 pitted the Building Industry and Farm Bureau against environmental groups and a group of wealthy benefactors, including Bill Gates, Harriet Bullitt, James Roush, and Douglas Walker. The premise of Initiative 933 was simple. If a regulation kept the landowner from using property fully, government would have to compensate the landowner for the loss of or waive the restrictions altogether. From early on in the campaign season, the coalition supporting the initiative was at a disadvantage. They raised less money and had to combat the example set by a similar initiative in Oregon, which has racked up $6 billion in claims since its passage in 2004. Howard Rich's Americans for Limited Government donated $360,000 to I-933. It also funded similar initiatives facing voters in at least six other states. With the measures apparently headed for defeat in California and Idaho, the measures were headed for approval in Arizona, Nevada, North Dakota, and Michigan. Washington supporters intended to continue the fight in the legislature. This from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
In Washington, D.C., activist Cindy Sheehan was arrested yesterday as she led about 50 protesters to a White House gate to deliver anti-war petitions she said were signed by 80,000 Americans. Sheehan was arrested along with three other women on the sidewalk outside the White House gate. They were charged with interfering with a government function. Before she was arrested, she joined the protesters in hailing the outcome of Tuesday's elections and chanting "Stop the War" outside the gate. The petitions opposed use of military force to resolve the dispute over Iran's nuclear program. Yesterday's protest came as Republicans lost control of the House and the White House announced the resignation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
And Democrats won a 51st seat in the Senate and regained total control of Congress after 12 years of near domination by the Republican Party. The shift dramatically alters the government's balance of power, leaving President Bush without GOP congressional control to drive his legislative agenda. Democrats hailed the results and issued calls for bipartisanship, even as they vowed to investigate administration policies and decisions. Democrats had 229 seats in the House, 11 more than the number necessary to hold the barest of majorities in the 435-member chamber. Democrats will have 9 new senators on their side of the aisle as a result of Tuesday's balloting. 6 of them defeated sitting Republican senators from Pennsylvania, Ohio, Missouri, Rhode Island, Montana, and Virginia. The other 3 replaced retiring senators from Maryland, Minnesota, and Vermont.
And Democrats wrested control of the Senate from Republicans yesterday with an upset victory in Virginia, giving the party complete domination of Capitol Hill for the first time since 1994. Jim Webb's squeaker win over incumbent Senator George Allen gave Democrats their 51st seat in the Senate, an astonishing turnabout at the hands of voters unhappy with Republican scandal and unabated violence in Iraq. Allen was the sixth Republican incumbent senator defeated in Tuesday's elections. The Senate had teetered at 50 Democrats, 49 Republicans for most of Wednesday, with Virginia hanging in the balance. Webb's victory ended Republican hopes of eking out a 50-50 split, with Vice President Dick Cheney wielding the tie-breaking authority. This according to The Guardian.
In Pensacola, Florida, the touchscreen voting machines Catherine Harris championed as Secretary of State after the 2000 presidential recount may have botched this year's election to replace her in the U.S. House, and it's likely going to mean another Florida recount. More than 18,000 Sarasota County voters who marked other races didn't have a vote register in the House race, a rate much higher than the rest of the district, election results show. Sarasota County Election Supervisor Kathy Dent defended her staff in the voting machines, arguing that the thousands of voters must have either overlooked the race or simply decided not to vote for either candidate. The race was pushed to a second screen by a glut of minor U.S. senator candidates on the ballot. Florida law requires a machine recount if the difference between the top candidates is less than 0.5%. If the machine tallies find a margin of less than 0.25%, a manual recount is conducted.
Dennis Hastert announced yesterday that he will not run for leader of the House Republicans when Democrats take control in January. His decision to step down from the leadership cleared the way for a likely succession battle among lawmakers who faced the sudden loss of power after a dozen years in the majority. Representative John Boehner of Ohio, currently the majority leader, is expected to run for leader, and Representative Mike Pence of Indiana announced during the day that he also will seek the post. Joe Barton of Texas has signaled he too may join the field. Hastert first conveyed word of his plans in a conference call with fellow GOP leaders one day after Republicans lost control of the House in midterm elections.
Robert Gates, a former director of the CIA during the presidency of George H.W. Bush, is part of Texas's good old boy network. He may be best known for playing a role in arming Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein with American-made weapons in the country's war against Iran in the 1980s. Gates, who is currently is president of Texas A&M University, came under intense fire during confirmation hearings in the early 1990s for being unaware of the explosive situation in Iraq in the 80s and the demise of the Soviet Republic. Gates joined the CIA in 1966 and spent 8 years there as an analyst before moving over to the National Security Council in 1974. He then returned to the CIA in 1980, and a year later was appointed by Ronald Reagan to serve as Deputy Director for Intelligence. 5 years later, he was named Deputy Director for the agency, the number two post in the agency. In 1989, he was appointed Deputy Director of the National Security Council, and in 91, when the first Bush administration was in office, he was named Director of the Spy Shop. During contentious Senate confirmation hearings in October of 91, Gates' role in cooking intelligence information during the Iran-Contra scandal was revealed. If confirmed, Gates would arguably be overseeing a war that removed a dictator he personally helped to prop up. Tom Harkin, a senator from Iowa, described Gates' role in the intelligence-sharing operations with Iraq during a time when the United States helped arm Saddam Hussein in Iraq's war against Iran. This from a Truth Out report. And outside the White House yesterday, more than 100 religious leaders, survivors of tortures, and concerned citizens gathered to mourn the passing of a cornerstone of American law. Many of the marchers wore soggy orange jumpsuits and black hoods over their faces, representing the more than 400 men who remained in prison at Guantanamo. The gap between the Bush administration's agenda and the other concerns of activists outside could not have been greater. The Military Commission Act establishes new rules for interrogating and trying suspected terrorists. It also suspends habeas corpus for any foreign citizen determined to be an unlawful enemy combatant engaged in hostilities or having supported hostilities against the United States. While President Bush called the law a way to deliver justice to the terrorists we have captured, the majority of those held at Guantanamo do not fit under even this exceptionally broad definition of unlawful enemy combatant. A Seton Hall Law School analysis of the Pentagon's own findings reveals that the U.S. government considers only 8% of 507 Guantanamo detainees to be al-Qaeda fighters. Of the remaining detainees, 40% have no definite connection to al-Qaeda or the Taliban. This from In These Times.
A Missouri ballot initiative to promote stem cell research was approved by voters last night by a margin of 51 to 49. The push to pass the referendum is a key factor in Missouri's crucial Senate race. Democratic challenger Claire McCaskill wrote her support of the measure to take the seat of the incumbent Republican Jim Talent, who opposed the measure. Another controversial referendum, South Dakota's toughest in the nation law that would have banned virtually all abortions, even in cases of rape and incest, was strongly defeated by voters. That result was a tremendous blow to conservatives, as was Arizona, which became the first state to defeat a gay marriage ban. Conservatives did prevail in seven states where voters approved constitutional amendments to ban gay marriage. Nationwide, a total of 205 measures were on the ballots in 37 states, but none had riveted political activists across the country like the South Dakota abortion measure, passed overwhelmingly by the legislature earlier this year. It would have allowed abortion only to save a pregnant woman's life. Lawmakers had hoped that the ban would be challenged in court, provoking litigation that might eventually lead to a U.S. Supreme Court reversal of the 73 Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion. This according to Reuters.
In New Orleans, mental health problems soared after Hurricane Katrina, just as the city's ability to handle them plummeted. The situation created a crisis so acute that police officers say they take some disturbed people to destinations of last resort, which is jail. Because of the storm damage, only two of New Orleans' 11 hospitals are fully functioning. What's more, one of the closed facilities in the sprawling Charity Hospital, which police officers had relied on to drop off people at any hour. People who need medication can't find it or can't afford it, and the storm's aftermath has made life more stressful as well. A federally funded study published in the Bulletin of the World Health Organization found that mental health problems in the region roughly doubled in the months after Katrina. Police are answering an average of 185 mental health calls a month. The downsized police force finds itself shopping for hospitals willing to accept the mentally distressed, and among five area hospitals with working emergency rooms, one in New Orleans and four in neighboring Jefferson Parish. None specializes in mental crisis, and most appear hesitant to deal with the mental cases.
Toxic chemicals may be causing a pandemic of brain disorders because of inadequate regulation. A report in The Lancet identifies over 200 industrial chemicals, including metals, solvents, and pesticides, which have potential to damage the brain. Studies have shown low-level exposure to some can lead to neurobehavioral defects in children. The U.S. and Danish team behind the report said that one in six children worldwide has a developmental disability such as autism or cerebral palsy. The causes are unknown, but the researchers trawled through a range of previous studies and data to show how some chemicals can affect the brain. The team said pinning down the effects of industrial chemical pollution was extremely difficult because symptoms may not develop for several years. The report said lead illustrated the risk of even low exposure of industrial chemicals for kids. Based on what's known about the toxic effects of lead, this may have reduced IQ, shortened attention span, slowed motor coordination, and heightened aggressiveness. The scientists identified 202 industrial chemicals with the potential to damage the human brain, and they said this was likely to be just the tip of a very large iceberg. This from the BBC.
In Waukee, Iowa, one man hopes to light a fire under his idea of using manure to produce heat and electricity. John Kimberlin believes he has perfected a small-scale furnace that can be used up on farms, at racetracks, or anywhere else livestock waste piles up. Investors have worked to turn manure in biomass into energy, and scientists say it could make Iowa a major producer of power. The state produces enough manure to power 325,000 homes. There also are tax incentives that encourage the development of methane digesters to create electricity and control odor. Kimberlin said he came up with the idea of building a manure furnace from the tons of horse manure he had on his farm west of Des Moines. He needed to find some way to get rid of it, and he said he couldn't spread it on his own land without contaminating the water, and hauling it away would be more expensive. Kimberlin did some small experiments and spent time at the Iowa State University Library researching his idea. He eventually received a patent and found some investors, and they formed a company called Nature's Furnace, Incorporated, and are planning to make and sell several different kinds of furnaces. Kimberlin said the company wants to keep the size of the furnaces small so they can be portable.
The leader of the Palestinian group Hamas has called on his fighters yesterday to activate resistance just hours after an Israeli artillery strike killed 18 civilians, mostly women and children, from a single extended family in Gaza. Khaled Mashal, who lives in exile in Damascus, promised retaliation after a wave of artillery shells landed before dawn on a residential street in Beit Hanun. Several homes were hit, all belonging to one family. The attack sparked international condemnation and came a day after the Israeli military ended a six-day operation in Beit Hanun that claimed more than 50 lives. More than 350 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza by the Israeli military in the past 5 months alone. Our condemnation will not be in the words, but indeed, said Mr. Mashal, all Palestinian groups are urged to activate resistance. Hamas agreed to a truce that began 18 months ago, but it expired at the end of last year. Hamas militants have since fired rockets into Israel, but the call to arms risks a return to suicide bombings. Israel's military halted all artillery strikes into Gaza yesterday, and said it had appointed a general to investigate the shelling. This according to The Guardian.
Nicaragua's president-elect Daniel Ortega has said he will not impose any radical change in economic policy on the country. The one-time revolutionary who claimed victory in Sunday's election says he wants to maintain economic stability. The U.S., which had campaigned against Ortega, has pledged to work with him if his government backs democracy. But Ortega says he wants to ensure dignity for the 80% of Nicaraguan families who live on $2 a day or less. Washington had previously warned that Ortega's election could lose Nicaragua U.S. aid, such as it is. Ortega was congratulated by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Other regional leaders were also quick to praise Ortega on his victory, including a leftist ally from his earlier period in power, Cuban President Fidel Castro. This from the BBC.
Former President Jimmy Carter has rejected criticism by an observer mission headed by America's ambassador to Nicaragua, Paul Trivelli, questioning the Nicaraguan election's accountability. The ex-president asserted that, quote, there are no doubts regarding the election's integrity, unquote. Carter also recalled that the communique by the Trivelli group was issued on Sunday before the voting concluded. The U.S. Embassy had few observers, while the OAS, the European Union, and the Carter Center sent around 700 experts. All the international and national observing organizations coordinated in highlighting the Nicaraguan electoral process's accountability. This from Prensa Latina.
And Nobel Peace Laureate Wangari Maathai launched a campaign yesterday to plant a billion trees next year, 32 every second, to highlight the need to tackle global warming. Professor Maathai, who won the prize in 2004 for her work on reforestation in Kenya, pledged to plant 2 million trees through her Green Belt movement. The Billion Tree Campaign is being backed by the United Nations Environment Program, this according to The Guardian.
The United Nations General Assembly adopted yesterday a resolution against the blockade imposed by the United States on Cuba, with 183 favorable votes, 4 against and 1 abstention. That document was approved with a record number of votes in 15 years that the resolution has been adopted. This from Prensa Latina also.
A ship carrying some 3,000 metric tons of toxic waste has arrived in the French port of Le Havre from the main Ivory Coast city, Abidjan. The waste, which is to be neutralized, was dumped in Ivory Coast in August and has been blamed for causing the deaths of 10 people there. Ivory Coast has begun an inquiry into the waste shipped by a Dutch firm. The ship, MN Toucan, arrived in Le Havre after a 10-day journey from Abidjan with 141 sealed containers on board. France's ecology minister said Ivory Coast has asked for French help because it was not able to treat the waste. Further waste shipments between Ivory Coast and France are expected. And Dutch firm Trafigura was denied responsibility for dumping the waste in the city of Abidjan, saying it employed a local company to dispose of it. Trafigura first attempted to discharge the chemical slops in the Dutch port of Amsterdam in early August, but the company that was to dispose of the waste suddenly increased its charge dramatically, asking for 40 times more to treat the waste. Trafigura refused, and the tanker reached Nigeria, where there it failed to reach an agreement on disposable arrangements with two local firms to dump the 500 cubic meters of waste. Only in Ivory Coast did it manage to find a company to handle the waste. This is from the BBC.
Militia loyal to Somalia's Islamic courts have stormed and recaptured a ship hijacked by pirates off the Somali coast. Six of the pirates were captured after a gun battle, and all 14 crew members are reported to be unharmed. The charcoal-carrying freight vessel seized a week ago was being held for a $1 million ransom. Somalia's coastline is notorious for piracy, but incidents have declined since the Islamists took power in June. The Union of Islamic Courts has promised to restore law and order in the territory it controls. A Kenyan official said the ship was being taken to the Somalia capital Mogadishu. This from the BBC.
The parliament in the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan has adopted a new constitution curbing presidential power and boosting that of legislators. The parliament session follows a week of protests in the capital of Bishkek. Cheers and applause filled the parliamentary chamber as the majority of the MPs pass a new constitution. It still needs to be signed by President Kurmanbek Bikiev, but legislators say that is now a mere formality. This from the BBC.
The European Commission has given Turkey until mid-December to open its ports to Cypriot ships or face unspecified consequences. The warning is set out in a report criticizing the pace of Turkish reforms in the year since EU entry talks began. The Commission says it will make relevant recommendations to EU leaders if Turkey does not meet its obligations towards Cyprus. Correspondents say the leaders may opt to freeze Turkey's membership talks. The decision would be made at a summit in Brussels by mid-December. This from the BBC. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, November 9th, 2006. Thanks for listening. And thank you for becoming a member of KBOO. You make all the difference. If you haven't become a card-carrying member of KBOO yet, well, it's never too late to have a happy membership.
And today's editor is Chris Andre. Our engineer is Steve, and Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Chris Andre. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220 HR.
The Portland area weather calls has a chance of showers this morning, then showers likely in the afternoon. The slight chance of thunder showers, highs about 55. Tonight, mostly cloudy, slight chance of showers and rain likely after midnight, lows in the 40s.
We really would love to have you volunteer in the KBOO newsroom. Volunteers are asked to please pick up the phone, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202, or email her at amnews@kboo.org. Coming up on your listener-supported, volunteer-powered community radio at 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. She'll discuss what's next for Oregon following yesterday's elections.
And at 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell.
At 9:30, Martha Odom interviews Adele Kubine of Military Families Speak Out about the long-term effects of deployment to Iraq on soldiers and their families.
And at 10, it's Chicanismo, host Carlos Chavez presents Part 2 of the Mexican-American War, featuring a historian from the University of Southern California.
At 10:30, on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard welcomes Portland artist Brad Adkins. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Once again, we are sending this broadcast out to people in the Middle East who work tirelessly for peace.
the community calendar for Thursday, November 9th. Local animal rights activists are having the first official meeting of Oregon Primate Freedom, a grassroots animal liberation group that will focus on primate vivisection. The meeting will be held tonight from 6 to 7 p.m. at Laughing Horse Books. That's at the corner of 10th Avenue and East Burnside Street in Portland. Everyone is encouraged to attend and get involved. There will be a showing of two short DVDs at the beginning of the meeting. For more information, contact Oregon Primate Freedom at yahoo.com. The Primate Freedom Project is dedicated to ending the use of non-human primates in biomedical and harmful behavioral experimentation. The Archaeological Legacy Institute and Portland State University Department of Anthropology are pleased to present the best films from the 2006 edition of the Archaeology Channel International Film and Video Festival. This will be presented this weekend at the Fifth Avenue Cinema. That address is 510 Southwest Hull Boulevard in downtown Portland. This series is a benefit for the festival, an annual spring event in downtown Eugene, Oregon, and the only film competition of its genre in the Western Hemisphere. Movie programs begin at 7:30 p.m. Ticket sales are $6 at the door. Blood of the Vikings, Episode 1, First Blood, from the U.K., and The Kingdom of the Nabataeans, from Petra to Madin Salah, from France, will be showing this Friday, tomorrow night. On Saturday night, November 11th, see In the Land of the Black Pharaohs from Switzerland or King Solomon's Tablet of Stone from the UK. For more information, call 503-725-3551, 503-725-3551, or visit the web at archaeologychannel.org. Learn how to reduce costs, increase energy independence, and explore the ethics of energy consumption at workshops on Tuesday, November 14th at First United Methodist Church. That address is 305 East 11th Street in the Dalles, Oregon. The workshops for congregations will be held from 12 noon to 2:30 p.m. and individuals from 6 to 8:30 p.m. Keynote speaker is Doug Bolin of Cascade Solar. This event is sponsored by Oregon Interfaith Power and Light and the Oregon Department of Energy. Admission is $7 at the door. For more information, visit the web at emoregon.org. Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon Environmental Ministries connects, informs, and empowers individuals and congregations to work for justice and the care and renewal of the earth. EMO is a statewide association of 17 Christian denominations, including Protestant, Roman Catholic, and Orthodox bodies, working together to improve the lives of Oregonians through community ministry programs, ecumenical and interreligious dialogue, environmental ministry, and public policy advocacy. This has been the Community Calendar. I'm Alicia Olson for KBOO, listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, non-corporate, commercial-free radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from DEX, your source for local information, in the book, on CD-ROM, or online at dexonline.com.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight. Heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. It is a glorious day in a beautiful, beautiful state of Oregon. My name is Joanne Bowman. You're listening to Voices from the Edge. And I have a fabulous co-host here with me today. Good morning.
Hi, it's Jamila.
It's Jamila. Introduce yourself, and you know, people are going to say I'm a little giddy, and I may be a little giddy because, of course, I've been following all the local election news and the national election news, and it is truly a new day for our country. And as the music said, get up, stand up for your rights. I believe voters all over the country did just that less than 48 hours ago, and it really, for me, says that the country is ready for a new direction, new leadership, new vision. So, you know, be careful what you ask for, because now we got it. And that's the question. So what's the feedback that you're hearing, Jamila, from especially, and I hate saying this, I hate saying young folks, but it's like, okay, but from, you know, from the from your constituency groups, what are you hearing about the election? What are folks feeling?
I think there's a general sense that, you know, the reason why a lot of people say they haven't voted, because nothing's going to change. And so I've been talking to a few people, and I think that's still the general sense, but people feel like, well, particularly, you know, someone like me, which I voted ever since I could, but I feel, you know, a lot of the laws and the acts and so forth that are being created are pretty much for people like me, you know, people of color, working people, poor people, women. And so I feel, and I think a lot of people that haven't voted in the past feel the same way, voting on young people and people that work, and it's time for us to take a stand.
So I always mess up your name. Please forgive me.
It's okay.
Why is it that, I was going to let you know that young people voted at record highs in this election season.
Yeah.
So clearly young people knew what was at stake in this election, and they turned out in force to make sure their voice was heard. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And if you haven't guessed, we're actually doing an analysis of the 2006 general election today. And I'm hoping that some of my regular callers who self-identify as other party people will call in and tell me how they're still going to work to make this state better. Just because their party is not in power, their governor candidate didn't win, doesn't mean that they should just shut up and go home. That means that they have to figure out another way to actually stay engaged and involved in our democracy, because that's what democracy is about. I have to tell you, I was like blown away by some of the election results.
Yes.
I was blown away by how thoughtful Oregon voters especially were. We defeated some measures that conventional wisdom told us could not happen. We defeated parental notification across the state, which was fabulous. We defeated Tabor across the state, which was fabulous. We defeated the other tax cut, ballot measure 41. We in fact, and of course we passed the prescription drug purchasing pool by a margin of 72, 74.
71, something like
that. Yeah, a really high percentage. So clearly, Oregonians were certainly concerned about health care, and they were certainly concerned about what would happen if those dollars, those state resources, were all of a sudden cut by billions of dollars. And so it's amazing to me. Now, I'm a political I'm insane when it comes to politics. I read everything. I talk to everybody. I look, I researched on the web. But most people don't take the time that I take to really understand what's on the ballot. And so I'm pleasantly surprised to see that people who didn't pay a lot of time still could figure out, you know, the pros and cons. Yeah. Now, there was one interesting wrinkle in the election with the ballot measures. As you know, ballot measure 46 and 47 were a team. And 46 was the enabling legislation that would have changed the Constitution and allowed for campaign finance limits. Measure, so that was 46. 47 was actually the legislation itself that would have incorporated campaign finance limits. Now, the last time I looked, 46 was soundly defeated, but it looked like 47 was passing, which is very interesting. So I'd love to have a conversation with the listeners about, you know, why they rejected the constitutional change but actually passed the legislation itself, which means that the legislation can't be implemented because the constitutional change failed so miserably. So I'm also curious from that campaign, what's their next step? So it's like they have, and clearly it shows that Oregonians want campaign finance limits, but I never thought that this particular measure, 47, was the right way to go, because it attacked the problem from an individual's pocketbook. And it's like, how are you going to tell me where I can put my private money?
Yeah, wasn't that, that was the huge free speech issue, wasn't it? Where artists who feel differently couldn't campaign or put their money towards the, is that the
yes, that's exactly right. It was it would have had a big impact on nonprofits and other organizations that worked politically, didn't necessarily put money into political campaigns, but worked to hold leaders accountable.
Right.
It would have limited their ability to get money into their nonprofits and their organizations as well. That's absolutely right. And so 503-231-8187 is the number to call. So you want to talk a little bit about what's happening nationally?
Oh, I think I'm a great believer in karma, and karma's working. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, believe in karma, and karma's working. Well, I have to tell you, I was, you know, of course I have to say I was giddy yesterday when I found out that the U.S. Senate is also in Democratic control. But I heard this fabulous quote yesterday. And I understand it's attributed to our mayor, Tom Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote was, well, Democrats have 2 years to show that they can lead. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was absolutely a wonderful quote.
Yeah.
And I think it's absolutely true, because already we're seeing media slants that talk about, well, you know, the public's concerned that, you know, Democrats may pull out of the war too soon.
Mm-hmm.
They're concerned that Democrats, you know, haven't come up with a plan yet, you know. And the reality is that I think even though everybody was hopeful that there would be some major changes taking place, I don't think anybody was ready for the massive change that took place so quickly on election night. And actually, I was right here in this studio on election night when I started hearing all that great news coming in. So, what do you think will change, Jamelia, on the national front now that in January, both houses of Congress will shift over to Democratic control?
I think there will be a slight emphasis on class issues. I think.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
A slight.
Yes, slight.
Okay.
I'm a young person.
Make your case.
I think that in terms of money going towards the military and more into, more nonprofit programs, not necessarily, hopefully there'll be less of an emphasis on the welfare to work program and sort of trying to deal with that issue. Well, there'll be, I think, more of an emphasis on education programs, is education and working people and programs. And I know there's a huge, I know Hillary Clinton is once again senator, and that's a huge deal. Elliot Spitzer is governor.
Yes.
I'm from New York, so that's a
big. So you've been following
but,
the New York
races,
huh?
And so that's because a lot of the, you know, although everything's going towards the Democrat Party, I think, you know, there's still an if-or situation in terms of this war. And, you know, I heard something yesterday. They were telling about now, you know, because there's such a lead in the Democrat Party, now they have to, instead of using a pencil where they can erase, actually use a pen to figure out, you know, if they want to get the troops out of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at what point do they do that? At what point, you know, how they do it, they have to really be firm on how they do it. And so I think they will be a bit more firm on how they do it and look more towards taking money out of that and having Middle East sort of not completely pull out financially, but I think, you know, having more independence on their part. And I think in terms of Israel, I think they'll still, that's a really iffy one. I think they're going to still use a pencil on that because it's so financially connected.
Mm-hmm.
But, so yeah, in short terms, I think they'll pay more attention to education issues, a little bit more in class, not as much as I would like. But, you know, and then I think they would, you know, make a faster decision on how to deal with Iraq.
Well, I mean, you raise an interesting point because I absolutely agree that the war is clearly a big issue on people's mind this election season. And I believe a lot of the votes around the country really reflected people's views on the war. My big concern would be, however, is I don't want Democrats to fall into a trap of, you know, standing up today and saying in 100 days we're pulling out of Iraq or, you know, because the reality is that even though most of us didn't want to be there in the first place, we're there now and we have to be logical and strategic about how we pull out and how we reinvest in Iraq so that we make that community whole again because, you know, they were doing not too bad before we showed up.
Right.
Now that we've blown up everything, we actually have a responsibility to help rebuild that country. And so 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm Joanne Bowman. I have my guest co-host Jamal here.
Jamila.
Jamila. I don't know, Jamila. I have this block in my brain when it comes to your name. I am so, so sorry.
It's okay.
Jamila is here co-hosting with me today, and we want to hear from you. Are you still out celebrating, or are you like in mass depression? Are you optimistic? Do you have hope for what's going to happen in the future here in Oregon as well as in the rest of the country? Or are you just have you just thrown up your hands and decided, oh, I gotta move? that's the question that's on the table. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You know, clearly one of the races that we had to wait the longest to find out about was the U.S. Senate race out of Virginia. And ultimately, yesterday, on election night, it was too close to call and nobody was calling it. Yesterday, it became really clear, however, that the Democratic candidate had, in fact, picked up enough votes in order to win that seat. And so that's what gave the Democrats their majority in the U.S. Senate. So it was, I mean, I have to tell you, I told somebody that, you know, I've been voting, I won't tell you how many years I've been voting, but just trust me that I've been voting every year since I was 18. And what's interesting is this is probably the first election in my memory where 99.9% of what I wanted to see happen on election day actually happened.
That's what a lot of people were saying.
Yeah, it's, so I'm feeling really good about this. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, your comment, we, you know, need to rebuild Iraq. Well, our corporations are over there rebuilding Iraq right now and ripping off the American taxpayer to the tune of billions of dollars.
That's absolutely true. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about supporting a failed policy. I'm talking about really going in there, having contracts where people actually have to compete for. And actually getting contracts to do the specific rebuild work. So I absolutely agree that what we're doing now is not a model that we should be wanting to emulate in January.
Well, it's pretty simplistic thing to say to go over there and rebuild. I don't think we'd ever get, you'd ever see the United States getting away from exploiting and profiteering over there. I don't know what the answer is. Maybe get other Middle Eastern countries in there to help rebuild. You know, there's huge amounts of money in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Not that there wouldn't be maybe some exploitation there also, but get our ass out of there. That's the damage is done, and just get the hell out of there and.
So you proposing just a cut and run strategy?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Call it
whatever you want. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to. You know, not immediately, but you know, what's happening now? I mean, what's your suggestion? Stay there and. We're getting our ass shot off. Thousands and thousands of Iraqis are getting killed. yeah, get the hell out of there. Thanks, bye.
Thanks, appreciate your viewpoint.
Yeah,
even though I think it's short-sighted, and it won't do anything for our standing in the world. But
yeah,
thank you for your call.
It's a really dangerous position to just get out immediately, and I think that's what's going on anyway, is isolating people, and if you do that, just pull out, then there's even more isolation. And instead of being an ally and just, you know, there should be more focus on community service in terms of staying over there as opposed to, you know, blowing people up. But I don't think we should just immediately pull out, because that'd be isolating a whole community of people.
And not only that, I mean, the reality is we've made it worse, not better. And so we have to figure out a way to make it better before we pull out. And that's our responsibility, since we're the ones that went in there and to other people's homeland and decided we were going to bring democracy to them. Thank goodness our democracy worked for us this time. Next caller. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. I've got a question and a comment.
All right.
My question is, I live in Legislative District 27,
okay,
in the Tigard area, and there was an open seat there, and Democrat Tobias Reed was running against Republican nominee Biggie. Do you know who won that race?
Tobias won that race.
Tobias Reed.
Yes.
Good. I voted for him. My comment is that what sounds to me like what you're saying is basically what George Bush has been saying. what I would do in at this time with the Iraq situation is exactly what happened in 1974, when the Democrats took over the Congress and they cut off the funds to the Vietnam War. Nothing would have ever stopped that war except that was cutting off the money. Just give them nothing and send the helicopters in, remove all United States citizens from Iraq, and let them run their own country. Otherwise, the Democrats will be just like the Republicans. They will continue to murder and butcher, and they'll never stop until the money is cut off. And that's my opinion.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you sharing your opinion this morning. Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You're listening to Voices from the Edge. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Would that be me?
That would be you.
Okay, I know there's some background noise, so I'm going to try to move a little bit here. Anyway, thanks so much for taking my call, Joanne.
You're welcome.
You're wonderful, as always.
Thank you.
But my word for the new folk in is that they keep the light shining on the neocons, so they can't be doing their sneaky things.
Mm-hmm.
And setting them up for failure. You know, setting the new guys up for failure. You know how that goes. You know how the setup
exactly,
works.
Exactly.
And I want the new guys. I mean, I wish we had a parliamentary representation so we didn't have to just depend on. I guess we do a little bit, don't we? We now have
two U.S. senators that are independents.
Yeah.
So we're slowly getting there.
So a little bit by little bit, and that's wonderful. But anyway, I would urge the ones who have attained some stature now to be nice,
mm-hmm,
be decent, please don't lie, cheat, and steal, and for God's sake, stay in their own pants.
Amen.
Amen, sister. Because that's the only thing that seems to ever bring out the news.
That's true. That's
no
true.
What,
that's always the downfall of Democrats, huh?
Horrible things that people can do. But even so, they don't need to do any of that nasty stuff that's been going on.
But
they really don't.
You've raised an excellent point, and that was something I was talking to some folks at a celebration yesterday about. You know, Democrats have the opportunity to really show how you can be a true leader without being nasty, without being arrogant, without being obnoxious to the people in the minority party. I mean, if we're really going to move the country forward, then what the country has to see is that their leadership is working across party lines and they're working towards a common goal. And so, you know, that's what I want to see in January. I want to see this, renewed emphasis on bipartisan solutions to complex problems that we have. I mean, it would be just as bad if the Democrats went in and were just as arrogant as the Republicans have been. That would be just as bad for this country.
Amen, John, because we've had these years of the ignorant, the arrogant, and the smug. And I tell you, we need people, you know what? We need to have people out there who have spent their summers or their whole dang life picking beans.
That's right.
And picking berries.
That's right.
So that it is no longer, you know, people who work for a living in this country anymore are just held in just the highest of disdain.
Yes.
And that is so wrong.
That's what Jamelia was saying.
And this is how we've lost reality, is that people don't understand about working.
Right.
And I say, you know, maybe we just have too much technology and not enough smarts.
I think you raise a very valid point. I really appreciate your call this morning.
Thanks so much, Joanne.
Have a fabulous day, and thank you for taking
the
time.
Stay with us. Okay,
oh,
darling,
I'm here.
Pass the word. Okay,
thank you.
Them to stay in their own damn pants. Okay.
Have a good day.
Okay,
bye-bye. Bye now. 503-231-8187. That sounds like sound advice for the incoming Congress and the incoming state legislative body as well. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I do feel hopeful from this election, mostly just because seeing my brothers and sisters come out en masse to vote.
Yes, yes.
But if you've seen movies like Why We Fight, I don't know if you have, but
no.
you know that most of this economy is built on war, and
yes.
the paradigm shift that's needed is gigantic.
That's right.
And the neocons, I love that there was change. I really do. I don't want to discount that, but the Democrats ran the country for a long time, and they still let it go to a war economy. And so my hope, is pretty short-lived. although I love to see the people in this country came out again, and
yes.
they spoke. So
yes.
that's always a beautiful thing, and I think that's what's keeping me high right now. But my faith will come in action, and I'm hoping to see something better. But I hope this doesn't calm people down on the left that are excited about stopping the war, because we
yeah.
need to be just as persistent with these guys as the Christian
yeah.
coalition was with their people when they got in. So.
Absolutely. And, you know, you raise an excellent point, because, no, there is absolutely no way that we can rest on our laurels now, because clearly one of the challenges leading up to this election has always been really having the Democrats clearly define who they are mm-hmm. as compared to the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Up until this election season, it was almost enough to just not be Bush, you know?
Anyone but Bush.
Yeah. however, it was inspiring this time to see that really the focus were on issues. You know,
mm-hmm.
it was really about health care.
Mm-hmm.
It was really about taxes. It was really about education. And so it was wonderful to see that was where people focused their energy this time. And
yeah,
really,
I just hope that the message is mostly controlled by the media, and
right.
the media hasn't changed ownership since Monday.
Right.
So,
the
message will be controlled by whatever they want at the time. So hopefully the people are just loud enough that we keep the message on our side. But my grandpa told me, when you're in a hole, the key is to stop digging. So, in Iraq, stop digging. We know what's caused the issues so far, and it's the corporate issues, and it's the way we've written their constitution to begin with. So, we need a complete change there, like you said. And,
say again.
We have to change the way we talk about it, too, because if we sound like Bush, we're going to get in trouble.
Oh, yeah. Well, I certainly don't want to sound like Bush, and my feelings were hurt when the last caller told me that's what I sounded like. So
I know what you mean, but the right-wingers still think that you're saying the same thing as Bush.
Oh.
Thank you for being on the air.
Thank you. Appreciate your call.
My hope is that because more people came out and looked at specific issues and connected them, my hope is that the people that are in the Senate and the House now, that people do hold them accountable even more because we voted for them. And well, so we didn't, you know, vote for all those other people that were appointed.
Right.
And so because we, you know, as public citizens, they are, you know, accountable to us. And hopefully, you know, we don't get lazy like we did during Clinton's tenure.
Right.
And, you know, the economy is great. Okay, whatever. And then Bush came in and, you know, that whole thing. So hopefully, you know, we do hold all of these people even more accountable because we voted for them. And hopefully, you know, they do deal with issues and do pull out as soon as possible in terms of this war. But yeah, I think we need to deal more with community activism in those areas.
Well, and I absolutely agree with you, Jamala, as well as the caller, that, you know, advocacy doesn't stop because your party win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, advocacy picks up when your party's in power mm-hmm. because your expectations are higher mm-hmm. than they would be if the other party was in power.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the phone line. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So congratulations, Joanne, for putting up with the Oregon action. And I just wanted to say a little shout out to all the Marines, the ground troops of the Green, and the change of the people that went out and knocked on the doors.
Hold for just a sec, okay? Because I want to definitely get into that, because that was actually, talk about the ground troops that made the difference. By the way, we're listening to KBOO Portland. Thank you.
Okay, so I just want to say thanks to all the ground troops out there that really made things happen. And what we really need to stay focused on is not what we're going to do now, but we can stay focused a little bit on that, but we need to start shooting for 2 years and 4 years from now. We need to start laying down the tracks.
That's right.
To have an ultimate outcome. And that's what they did. It took them 20 years to
that's
do what
right.
they did.
Yes.
And they got in, and now they've just, you know, just completely dissolved on this. Everything just imploded. So we really need to start laying down the ground, the tracks, and start looking at ultimate goals, short and long term. And long term, we need to talk about 4 years from now.
Exactly.
Keeping our people in the houses and the senates and all that stuff 4 years from now, 6 years from now. And so everybody really worked hard here. And like that guy said before, really we're at the Democrats are just as bad. So we really need to start laying the tracks down for another party.
I absolutely agree with you that we have to stay focused, but I disagree. They're not as bad.
Well, yeah, well, they're all purchased by the corporate. They're all in the corporate pockets.
Absolutely true. They're all getting money from the same trough.
And
so
we gotta remove
no
that.
Question about that.
Yeah, we got to get rid of that.
But I don't
want
to wait. Hold on for a sec. But we have lived. You know, I remember in 2000 when people said it didn't make a difference who they voted for.
Well,
right?
Yeah.
I remember in 2004 we heard the same thing. Clearly we know there's a difference between, it does make an enormous difference who is actually in control of Congress and who's in control of our legislative body.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to leave that out there, but everything else you've said I agree with.
Yeah, and you know, Kulongoski, I mean, this guy is, really for the people by the people. This guy really is a force of he's a warrior. I see him fighting for children. I see him fighting for the future. The guy came up out of in foster care.
Right.
I mean, this guy really is, we're going to give him another couple years to check it out, but I think this is a good opportunity for us to start laying the tracks out for another party. We've got enough ground troops out there. We can start doing some things for the Dems, but then we can start laying out and getting another party in there so we can really start seeing democracy happen. And congratulations, Joanne, and everybody at KBOO and everybody out there working hard. I really appreciate everybody out there, and that's what my phone call is about today.
So, well, thank you so much. Appreciate the call. Have
bye.
A great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Election night, I was at work all through the night, and when I got off at 8 in the morning, I knew we'd taken the House, but I didn't know about the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't as ecstatic as you were,
mm-hmm.
Joanne, because I was in shock. I couldn't believe that we'd made headway anywhere at any time. It's just there's a point where you've been under for so long.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know exactly
and
what
I'm
you're saying.
And I'm starting to realize today...
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
there is something that makes me pause is what I'd heard Ralph Nader say on the Democracy Now! Show about if we did get enough Democrats in to take the House and the Senate, that unless they actually started acting like Democrats instead of Republican Democrats,
Republican light,
it wouldn't
is what
really
I call
matter.
It.
And you know, it's true. That's sort of been my complaint with Mrs. Clinton. I think she plays political games, and I know that that's what politics is all about. The nonpartisan thing is just a word you use just to play games, you give so much and then you get so much. The problem is the way the bills have been going through, really bad stuff's been tacked on to
exactly.
A lot of the bills,
right.
And I'm a little worried. But Ralph Nader said that he didn't think even if the Democrats did get the Senate and the House, that we would be pulling troops out, and that we wouldn't change our policy in Palestine with the Palestinians and the oppression that they've been feeding behind us,
mm-hmm.
because we're the power behind Israel.
Right.
Anyway, I just wanted to say one thing about the last caller. I'm glad he's happy, but I didn't vote for Kulikovsky because I don't like him. And you know, I did not vote for Saxton.
Right.
But I just picked. I think it was a Green or
the Green Party.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not. The reason I don't like Kulikovsky is he started out when he was first elected just totally pro-business,
mm-hmm.
and I was very surprised. He seemed very Republican and very non-people. I work in social services, and
mm-hmm.
so having health coverage is mm-hmm. is just really important. And he didn't follow up on the previous governor's Oregon health plan, which I thought needed a lot of support because it was a good health plan.
It was a good health plan,
yeah.
That's been just devastated,
and so have our clients because of it.
Right.
Our clients go to the hospital for the littlest things. Because they don't have doctors.
Right. And the insanity of that, because the cost is so enormous. And of course, but if you don't have health care, you go where you can get seen.
Mm-hmm.
And the emergency room ends up being a health care provider of last resort.
Yeah, and then I see Kulikovsky off on little business trips to other countries for who knows what. And it makes me irritated. I'm not fond of him. We need a lot of money to be poured into mental health. And
well, you know, you're raising some really good points, and I know that I know how challenged the governor was when we had a very strong supermajority in the House of Republicans, mm-hmm. and then even though we had a supermajority of Democrats in the Senate, as you know, any bill has to actually pass both houses and then go to the governor's desk. And so the governor, his side would say that he was frustrated because he could never ever get both houses to send him good legislation, right? Either the House would send something that was totally unacceptable, the Senate would pass really good legislation, but it would never be heard in the House because of Speaker Menace not even assigning it to committees. That sounds good to be able to say former Speaker Menace.
Oh, she's not in.
Because, no, she did retain her seat, but
because
the Republicans are in the minority now, she will just be a regular old legislator.
I heard, just real quick, and then I'll get off.
Okay.
I heard on the news this morning that a lot of young people voted.
Yes.
And
record
I don't
numbers.
Watch TV, but I turned it on last night because I still wasn't sure about the Senate.
Right.
And it was all these young people being interviewed and being asked, why was this election important to them? You know what?
Right.
And they had formed focus groups. Some were college students.
Right.
Just to talk about why there wasn't money coming into the infrastructure, and wasn't that more of a mm-hmm. fighting terrorism? You know, to have a strong country, you need the money inside the country, supporting the people and getting them well, like the mental health mental health needs, and getting the infrastructure for light rail and whatever to help the pollution of cars. just money money staying in the country as opposed to billions going for bombs.
Exactly.
And so there might just be, you know, this, the young people just might be opening their eyes and getting with it. I hope people, I know, like myself, there are a lot of people that are working and can't investigate a lot of,
right.
you know, get all the information.
Right.
I listen to this radio, but it is definitely one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
But of course,
we allow other folks
to
come on.
I'm glad. It's, at least there's, you know, it's, you know. Intelligence is represented somewhere.
Well, thank you.
Anyway,
yeah.
Bye.
But
bye.
Have a great day. We appreciate your call this morning. We let anybody come on KBOO, and
yeah.
You know, it's not like some of those right wing talk shows where if you don't have the right response, they don't let you come on at all. We don't screen folks out.
I think also the thing with young people, because they're pretty much minimizing how much financial aid college students can get. I think that's a huge issue for young people.
I think you're right.
Is the financial aid issue.
That's right.
It's going into military, so what do we
mm-hmm.
do? And there's, you know, environmental issues such as, you know, with cars, as you mentioned.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of issues that young people are personally concerned with.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was just really, I think the thing for me, one of the things I tried to research and couldn't really find was, in terms of mail-in ballots as opposed to the machines and sort of the ethnic disparity of where those are at. And so it was really hard for me to find. I found something from Blue Oregon that
mm-hmm.
was talking about, you know, the racial divide
mm-hmm.
in terms of issues. So, and they were saying, you know, Portland, because say something, Portland is, I think, number 29th in terms of quote-unquote liberal cities. And so these issues here are, you know, with college students and young people, there are more environmental issues and so forth and so on. But in terms of, you know, predominantly communities of color, I think those are more, like, they're more working issues and things like
mm-hmm.
that. So there's definitely a divide on that. So with definitely students, I think more in terms of, you know, in terms of war, because money's not going to them.
Right. Well, and not only that, they're of the war fighting age, right? So
drafting,
it's like if you
yes.
don't have
yes.
money to go
yes.
to school, then you end up
yes.
with this very few options. And
right.
one of them is to join the military
mm-hmm.
because they're trying to make it as enticing as possible.
Get money for college.
For folks to
yeah.
do just that. Mm-hmm. I think the caller made some really good points about just kind of being thoughtful in our approach to moving forward. My hope is that we don't put such high expectations on either the new Congress coming in and, you know, because it's very easy in this country for us to get critical within 30 days. If you remember when Clinton was elected, within 30 days they were calling for his impeachment,
right?
And so we need to give people the time to be the leaders that we know they can be. And we need to watch them. Doesn't mean we let them off the hook. It doesn't mean we let them get away with inaction. But we need to watch and support them as they move through this leadership challenge that's in front of them. I think it would be a big mistake for Democrats to come out with any major, this is what we're going to do right off the bat right now, because I think they do need time to really actually, now that they actually get to have much more information, they need some time to absorb that information and come up with some strategies that make sense short term as well as long term.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the phone line. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think that, I know that government, what's been happening has taken a lot longer than the last 6 years. But I think that the last 6 years were really necessary, because it woke us up. And now that we're woken up, I think that we need to keep that responsibility, and keep paying attention and keep making things happen. I think eventually we are going to get away from a two-party system. And I just want to put a shout-out to all the Greens out there or any of the other parties to start getting in at lower levels of government and stop running for governor and president.
Start somewhere, set your sights a little lower, huh?
Yeah. So I've had this theory for a while that mm-hmm. humanity is headed for a quantum leap, and any time that that happens intellectually, you have to take a huge step backwards. It's like a slingshot.
Right.
And I think we've seen that happening this last 6 years. So I'm hopeful that we're all starting to connect on a more intellectual, higher level.
Yes.
We're beyond using force and getting out there in the streets. And, you know, our revolts are different. And I think we've seen that in this election. And I'm really positive.
Wonderful. Hey, me too. I'm feeling really positive. And I do think that we've got the ability to build on what happened on Tuesday and to have realistic expectations about how quickly we can move forward to address some of these outstanding issues. I mean, we got big issues in the state. Let's just talk about Oregon. We got huge issues in the state that we have to deal with. As the last caller talked about, our mental health system is absolutely crumbling. We talk about our health care system. It's almost non-existent. You want to talk about education. It depends on where you live in the state, what the quality of your education is. That's just not acceptable as an Oregonian. You know, we can do so much better. But we need thoughtful people. We don't need people standing up giving propaganda or rhetoric to just, like, rally the troops. But we need people that are going to be thoughtful and sit down and create these really long-term solutions.
Right. No more pointing fingers. Time to take responsibility.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the Democrats have the ability right now to actually show what true leadership looks like, you know, and it shouldn't be gloating. It shouldn't be pointing fingers at the other side. It should be talking about what our president said he was going to do, which was, how do we bring together all of our community to work towards a common good, you know?
Right.
So, I'm hopeful too. I'm cautiously optimistic because I'm always concerned that expectations go up so high when a new party takes over that it's very easy to look at it and call it a failed administration in 30 days if you don't see the massive changes that you want to see right away.
Right. And we all need to be leaders ourselves and not hand over our responsibility so easily to someone else go on about our merry way. So.
Thank you for saying that.
So thank you. I'm going to get off and let somebody else talk.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
503-231-8187. Now, you know, I want to talk to one individual caller who calls me all the time, but he hasn't called today. He's been pretty silent. And he's the guy that calls me every single week to tell me how wonderful the Republican Party is and why everybody should be voting Republican.
Oh, that guy, yeah.
Now, and I know he's out there today, and I want you to call because absolutely I want to find out what you're thinking today and what's going on in your world. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Good morning, caller. Welcome to K-Book.
Good morning, Joanne. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent.
You know, I want to first of all speak on the notion that we shouldn't cut and run from Iraq. First of all, I don't buy into that notion that we should stay. Because in order for me to do that, then I buy into the notion that people of color cannot get their act together without European intervention. I mean, that's racist at its core. Those people had a great civilization before America came there. And also, you know, we forget that civilization started in that part of the world. And right. So I have no doubt in my mind that if America give those people the economic resources that is theirs and back away, I think they could get it together, personally.
Well, don't you think we have a responsibility for rebuilding all the hospitals and libraries and community centers that we destroyed when we came in to bring democracy to Iraqis?
Well, I think that you have a responsibility, but I think that those people, they have engineers and intellectuals over there, and I think that if you let them have their own money and do their own hiring, and quit giving American contractors the big contracts and
right.
then paying Iraqis,
right.
you know, slave wages,
right.
I think that would work. one of the things you have to understand is that America, as long as they over there, they setting up a puppet government. And this puppet government is doing whatever, you know, America's pulling the strings.
Mm-hmm.
So even if America physically left, you know, they're going to still have a puppet regime in place. So it's like they still going to be there anyway.
Right.
So I just don't think, you know, from my understanding, because if you look at the medical books and all the great scientific books, you won't find a lot of European names in there. You find a lot of other names in there of people of color that are really doing the scientific breakthroughs. So I have no doubt that these people can't do it themselves. Another thing, too, George Bush, real quick. It's interesting to note, and this is not my thinking, it's just what I picked up on the news,
right,
that his father now have put him under political arrest. And now his father is sending in the old guard to surround him. And that's why you see people now coming from his father's regime, now coming to take power, I mean, will surround him now. And what that tells me, basically, is that if the Democrats, you know, are not ready to play hardball, they're gonna end up in the same situation they've been in for the last
16 years.
Mm-hmm. I don't see the Democrats need, now that they got power, yeah, they need to work together and all, but they need to work, come from a position of strength, because Republicans have already demonstrated, man, that they hardball players.
They're vicious, no question.
So the Democrats got to be that way too.
Well, I mean, I think that I want to challenge that a little bit, because I actually think what the voters showed us is that hardball, in-your-face politics is the stuff that voters run away from. You know, voters want to see people that actually know how to work cooperatively to get things done. But part of me, I mean, my activist side of me wants to, like, totally support what you're saying, because it's like, okay, we finally got it back. You know, now we need to make sure that we show that, you know, that we were tough enough to get it back and we're tough enough to keep it. But there's a balance. I don't think it's all one way or the other. Now, here's a question I want to put out there for you. The thing that we're not talking about today, which I actually thought we'd be talking about, is which state voting machines failed. Now, what we know on election night were that there was the normal voter suppression activity taking place all over the country. And it's interestingly, in the places with the hotly contested races, mm-hmm. like Virginia, like in Maine,
Florida,
those were the places where there were recorded activity that was trying to discourage people from voting, mainly trying to keep the Latino voting population away from the polls.
There were a lot of calls to say vote on Wednesday.
Yeah, calls. I mean, it's amazing. They do the same tricks every year, but they are consistent with them. Every election year, they're consistent. They even tell people that they have to go to a new polling place. Mm-hmm. They tell people that the election's been moved. It's not going to be Tuesday this year. It's going to be some other day. I mean, it's amazing the things they come up with. But that I'm surprised that we're not having that conversation today. And so the question is it because we've talked about those electronic voting machines so much that people were paying especially close attention to those machines this year, so there was not the ability to change vote tallies? Or is it that we are just paranoid and the machines work fine and they've always worked fine and the 2000 and 2004 elections were just flukes?
No, I think personally, I think that they wasn't flukes. I think that what happened in this midterm election really reflected what happened in the first two national elections. I just think that the first time they probably got caught off guard. I think that was an awakening, at least for me.
Right.
And then the second time around, when they came back and did it, I think they just caught people off guard the second time around. The third time around, I think people was more up on it. I mean, because when I dropped my election off, I mean, my ballot, Man, I had the guy to show me some ID before I gave it to him.
Oh, good for you.
I think people was more aware, and even I talked to people down at the election office.
Right.
It was a good thing, because even the people down there at the election place was frustrated too behind the process.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
The way things were, and they wanted to see some changes themselves. So, it's a good day. I just think that I just hope the Democrats don't let the Republicans play them for chumps. You know what I'm saying? I mean, really, man, because they're good at that.
They are, and so, they are insidious. So, thank you. I really appreciate your thoughtful comments today.
I want to get to the first thing you were talking about. I totally agree with you. There were people in this country, such as, you know, the heart transplant and so on, people of color that invented great things that don't get any credit. And, I mean, the same thing with the Middle East. Definitely societies. You have the Alexandria Library. You have all of these great resources. However, if we totally pull out, if we took all of their resources and not replaced them, what are they going to do? And so I don't think that the military should stay there. I think there should be people doing community activism there and rebuilding. It doesn't necessarily have to be with U.S. money.
Right.
It could be just have people that support rebuilding the society. That is what I'm trying to get at. Not have the military stay there and you know, guard the oil. No,
right.
That's not. I'm talking about having, you know, people there as allies and supporting, and it doesn't have to be U.S. money. It could be coming from Venezuela, you know, somewhere that's not imperialist money, sure. But I think there should be people, if we blew up their resources, we need to be responsible and own up to that and help rebuild them. It doesn't have to be our money. So I totally agree with you on that end, but I don't think we should just pull out and leave them alone.
Right, and just say, you know, rebuild yourselves,
right.
Talk to you later. One of the other things, I absolutely agree with what you just said. One of the points I wanted to point out is ballot measure 45 was the ballot measure that would have reinstituted term limits in Oregon. and that was a measure that was soundly defeated.
Woo.
But I bet one thing that the listening public doesn't know is that that particular measure failed in every county in Oregon.
Wow.
Except one.
Uh-oh.
Except one county. But every county in Oregon soundly defeated this measure. Except two. And the two counties that actually passed it with a slim margin, but they did pass it, was Cook County and Klamath County. And so other than those two counties, every county, the other 34 counties all said no.
Wow.
To reinstituting term limits.
Yay.
So again, it sounds like voters really took the time to educate themselves. They didn't spend a lot of time, luckily, listening to TV commercials or listening to radio ads. They actually spent the time researching the issues and made good decisions. So kudos to the voters of Oregon for making really good decisions this election season. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello.
Hello.
The American people have spoken.
Yes, they have.
And I don't think they're waiting. They don't want to wait for things to start being fixed. That's why they...
Well, they at least have to wait
Democrats
to January.
Take over the Congress in, and the Oregon legislature. I think that the new Speaker of the House, the first woman Speaker of the House,
yes.
I listened to an interview that she had, and she spoke on Iraq, and she spoke about how our military presence there is provocative and how it is causing a lot of the violence mm-hmm. that is still occurring there. And if we're concerned about how we're going to pay for the reconstruction, perhaps we could have Halliburton give back the billions of dollars that was awarded to them to blow up the country and then to reconstruct it.
Right.
And give that to the Iraqi people and let them rebuild their own country. I ditto to your last caller. We have some kind of assumption that there aren't brilliant minds in Iraq.
Mm.
There aren't people who know how to get it together. I don't know where we get that arrogance from, but it's
imperialism.
Pretty faulty. And we also need to remember that now, in the Congress and the Oregon legislature, Democrats will be chairs of committees. Charlie Ringo is going to be the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, where they'll be looking at the tax structure.
Well, I mean,
Nancy Pelosi spoke about how we now have given the American people now have hope, and it's the Democrats' responsibility to honor that hope.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to start initiating legislation that's proactive rather than struggling to fight oppressive legislation.
Right. Well,
they need to start looking at...
You can do that when you're in leadership. You can actually start moving forward positive legislation.
And that needs to happen soon. And I know that they're, one of the first things they're going to do is look at the minimum wage laws again. But, you know, I agree with your last caller. The Democrats need to stand their ground. They can be cordial and cooperative with the president, but they have control of the Congress.
That's right.
They can initiate legislation and send it to him to sign. Well, and if he doesn't sign it, then that's on him.
You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I trust me, I'm not saying that they should be meek and they should just be singing "We Are the World" and we should all get along. I'm not suggesting anything.
I don't think the American people voted so much on the fact that they want cooperation. You know, a lot of the news political analysts now are just talking about the political moves that people are going to make now, da-da-da-da-da. They don't talk about the issues that are concerning the American people.
But that's
the
what the people were talking
lives,
about.
Liberty,
right.
And pursuit of happiness protected. And it hasn't been. We need to look at stopping the exploitation of our children and our grandchildren's lives in that military-industrial complex, in the prison-industrial complex. There's a bunch of gangsters that have been running our country.
You know, I just want to be cautious because half of those Democrats voted for the war.
Yep.
Right?
Right.
Half of those, most of the Democrats that are currently in Congress voted for the Welfare Reform Act. Most of those Democrats have voted for every harsh prison legislation that's come forward. So I don't want to give people a false impression that somehow we're going to have this giddy progressive legislative body.
But we don't need to be giddy then that Democrats took over unless the Democrats are willing to work together to start protecting the lives of the people in this country.
That's absolutely true. I'm just saying it doesn't happen immediately. It's not going to happen immediately, and the public has to watch and support the steps that are necessary to move forward that kind of good legislation.
Right.
It's just I just don't want people to think that in January
they can
when
start
they,
initiating them quick though. They don't have
at least
the discussion of them.
They have been.
Right.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
the call.
And one
thing I wanted to ask on a local level, speaking of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I just heard of another elderly family couple who's been in the community forever, who have a large extended family, who are now being harassed by one of those chronic nuisance letters from a sergeant in the police department. And I'm wondering who, is it one of the commissioners or is it the mayor's office that has oversight on those chronic nuisance procedures?
I don't know. I believe Randy Leonard is the commissioner that's responsible for that department, I believe.
But it's initiated by the police department, which is really strange.
But it's, the police department is the one
that has the oversight, you think?
Yes, I do believe that's so.
Okay. Thank you
so much. Appreciate the call. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, a member of military families speak out, discuss the long-term effects of deployment to Iraq on soldiers and their families. At 10, Carlos Chavez presents part two of the Mexican-American War, featuring a historian from the University of Southern California. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard welcomes Portland artist Brad Atkins. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, hear analysis of the new Democratic leadership in the House. Journalist Robert Perry looks at the life and works of Robert Gates, the Bush nominee for Secretary of Defense. And does Rumsfeld's departure leave him open to prosecution? All that's coming up today on Democracy Now! 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Is it me?
It is you.
Oh, well, good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
And I want to first of all say thank you so much for your show and thank you, KBOO. I'm going to be very brief because I've got to get in the car and go to work, but I'm kind of wanted to go back to the criticism of the governor, Kulongowski, and I had the same discussion at work yesterday with some of the people who reluctantly voted for him because he didn't get anything done. And one of the things, of course, is the fact that the House and the Senate were both Republican. And another...
Actually, the Senate was not.
Well... Okay, the House was. What you said, I agree with what you said. The reason he couldn't get anything done was because the Senate would pass bills and then the House wouldn't,
right.
They wouldn't go anywhere.
Right.
But another thing that was in the paper this morning and people need to be aware of, it said that when he took office, it coincided with the biggest percentage drop of general fund income since the Great Depression of 1930.
Hmm.
So, I mean, he has to be able to... He had to be able to try to do a lot with apparently a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, I need to get going because I need to get to work, but I just wanted to make that point. And again, thank you for your show.
Thank you. Appreciate the call this morning. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm Joanne Bowman. I have Jamila here with me, and we are here talking about the 2006 general election. Good morning, caller. Welcome to K-Boot. Hello? Hey. Good morning, caller.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
Oh, this is Leah Maka. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
I wanted to respond to two things. First of all, I have been hearing a lot, we've been listening a lot to the various military and other people who are talking about leaving Iraq and how we should do that. One of the things that I keep hearing is that the Iraqi people really want us to leave. What they're saying is that they want to take responsibility for their family and they want us out. I do believe we have responsibility for all the destruction we've done there. What I would be willing to support is take the military out, give them money and the resources, the equipment, the tools, the product so that they can rebuild their country, but we do need to get them out of there.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the military is there, the murders, the rape, the torture will continue. And that's they can't do what they need to do, although they're trying in spite of that.
Right.
So the second thing was, I heard Ralph Nader yesterday, I believe it was, on Amy Goodman, and I have to agree with him on his assessment. One of the things he said that was immediately taken off the table by the Democrats being elected, Nancy Pelosi, was the impeachment. And that, you know, we impeached Richard Nixon, and he resigned from the presidency for the exact same thing that George Bush is doing, which was the wiretapping, exactly the same thing.
Uh-huh.
So we still have a criminal president, we still have a criminal Congress, and we still have a majority of the Democrats, as you just pointed out, who voted for the war to stay, to increase, for the Patriot Act, for all those things. So I don't have a lot of confidence that... that we're going to see a huge changes. I'm delighted that Nancy Pelosi's there. I guess we'll see what she does with all of that. But I have to agree with Ralph Nader's assessment. So I don't think we're looking at a real progressive. I think we still have to realize that we've got the ball falls in my court.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to me. So I just wanted to respond to that.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your thoughtful comments this morning.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
That's why we hold all of them accountable.
Right. And the point is that I've always said the day after election, regardless of who wins, there's still a lot of work that has to happen. And so either you're happy and you're interacting with people who you have an affinity with, or either you're interacting with people that you would prefer not to ever have coffee with outside of a political event. But the reality is it's always our job is to be the opposition and to be pushing our elected leaders to do the things that we believe are right and just and necessary to make this country better. So I certainly don't want anybody to assume that now we can all go home and just put our feet up and relax, because there's a lot of work to do. And we know that Democrats are not known for what I want to say, creativity, or taking, or putting themselves out on a limb. You know, what we know about the Democratic Party is that they like to follow the political wind, and they're not going to be the ones that are out there with those bright, bold, fabulous new ideas. That comes from us, the people that are going to be advocating to make sure that they are, in fact, pushing the envelope further and fuller so that we get our issues addressed. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, yeah. Several calls back, a woman mentioned something about we need to get mental health care for people.
Yes, she did.
I've heard about this kind of stuff through the years. You know what? When people say that, here's what they mean. And they mean drugging people, labeling people, electroshocking. That doesn't heal people. What we need is healthy mental care. We need things like body massage, acupuncture, herbs, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I hear people say, yeah, we need a good mental health care, but not the kind that people know about or think that's right. That kind does not heal or help. It keeps people stuck and in their mind and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I wanted to say, another thing that's been griping me for years. Yes.
Lay it on me.
We need intelligent people. There's too much emphasis on intelligence. We need more of our, especially in this country, is humane.
Yes.
Sensitive.
Yes.
Feeling.
Yes.
Compassionate people.
Yes.
Intelligence is not the be or end all.
That's right.
It is just one of the important things a human being needs. Thank you.
Thank you. You are wonderful. Thank you for your call.
Oh, there's sorry.
I was going to say, she's right on the money.
Yeah.
Right on
there's
the money.
The one issue that I have with Kulongoski and others, with the issue of healthcare, they're focusing on children, but how
yes.
can you focus on children when the parents, you know, if the parents give out, you know,
yes.
where are the kids going to go? So I think we need to emphasize on healthcare for every single person.
Yes.
We need to, you know, when I've been here for 2 years, and before I moved here, you people were like, well, you can go wherever you want, and you have free healthcare here. I got, you know, I went here, and I had to get my teeth pulled out. I had to get all this stuff done. You have to pay up front.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm one of those people that have to go to the emergency room
mm-hmm.
because I can't afford it.
Right.
So we all need healthcare, because if the kids, you know, it's just
healthy kids with parents
right.
that are falling by the wayside right. is not a healthy family make.
Right.
You raise an excellent point, and that, and in fact, like when I heard Kulongoski on election night talking about covering all the kids, it's a mistake to think that you can cover all the kids and that somehow has solved our healthcare
mm-hmm.
crisis
mm-hmm.
as a state. You're absolutely right. We need to make sure And I know that there's work going on now mm-hmm. to actually move forward a statewide plan that would make sure that every man, woman, and child in our state has access to quality, affordable health care. I mean, and I know that there's a state Senate committee that's been working on health care for quite a while. Certainly, I've been working as part of community activists that have been working around trying to move universal health care forward. And we are in a position now, having the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion, to be able to actually put together a plan that we can actually roll out statewide that would do just that. It is inexcusable in a state with the riches that we have men, women, and children who cannot get access to basic health coverage. There should be no excuse for that, and that will be one thing I'd want to see at the top of the agenda for the next legislative session. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm well, and
excellent.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Say, it's Jeff in North Portland my listening post here, and I just wanted to very quickly recap my reaction as a registered Republican to the election of the last
couple
years ago. Yeah, well, I'm a log cabin Republican, but
well.
I've come to call them the log closet Republicans.
You're a faint, faint voice in the background.
But listen, here is the important key for all of my Republican friends and colleagues. This is an opportunity for this party to actually be chastised. You know what I'm saying?
Which party? Your party?
The Republican Party,
okay.
right.
Uh-huh.
This is a chastisement which is allowing us as Republicans then to be in a position of minority position in the state of the U.S. legislature. And this gives us a chance, and there's two schools of thought. One is, it gives us a chance to get to fighting weight, to stop being profligate with our spending habits, to stop being two-faced with our Rick Santorums, who thankfully is gone now.
He's gone.
And, because I'm a left-of-center Republican, by the way. But it's a chance for our party to really begin addressing, my party, the Republican Party, to really begin addressing where and where not they are serving the interests of the people of the United States rather than these special interests which have so long funded them. The second school of thought, and it's a little scarier, is that they're only, the ones that are still in Congress and Senate are only going to get worse and more bitter and uglier and nastier.
Yeah.
And I hope that second hypothesis is incorrect. I'd like to take this opportunity as a Republican to drag the party back from the hands of the Pastor Haggards and the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons. And here is our opportunity, because we have been successfully chastised by a learned electorate, if I may say so.
Mm-hmm.
You know where I'm coming from.
Very good point, yeah.
I hope it happens. I can't guarantee it. And there's all the opportunity in the world for the Republicans to get nastier and meaner than ever. But this is a chance for my party, the Republican Party of Oregon, the Republican Party nationwide, to get its act in gear and start doing what Democrats have to their error done for years, which is make nice. See, the Democrats love to make nice because they believe making nice will get you somewhere, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the chance for Republicans to learn exactly that. How are we going to make nice, if you know what I'm saying?
That's a very interesting point, because, you know, one of the things that always concerns me during election time is how vicious the campaign ads have become.
Mm-hmm.
And it clearly appears to be, and I, you know, not trying to take partisan positions, but it appears to be, for the most part, most of the ads are being produced by Republicans that are the ones that have such a vicious nature. And I know that there was at least one or two exceptions to that this election season.
But it goes even deeper.
Okay.
In that Republican operatives own the media companies, well, not the media companies, but the advertising companies that put these wicked, vicious, nasty things together. Mm-hmm. And then they gather the money from Republicans in the grassroots. They pour it into making these nasty ads. And then they take the rest of the money they've sucked out of the Republican grassroots and they pour it into placing these ads,
yes,
on what are ostensibly right-wing owned commercial,
that's right,
media companies.
That's right.
And so it's a vicious circle of, right, we're stealing money from grassroots Republicans, and we're pouring it into these interests that like the lobbyists, go hand in hand with both Republicans and Democrats off to Congress. So it's just ugly all over, and I'm hoping that we have an opportunity to really do some serious navel gazing as Republicans.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate
Thank you, Joanne.
Your thoughtful...
I love you. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay, talk to you soon. Take care. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. The caller raised some really interesting points. I know for me, it's like, after a month or so of being inundated with these ads, I tune out. I can't listen to them. I can't watch them. I don't want any part of them. And I know that it has a negative impact on the voting public, because I hear it over and over and over again. But what I was going to say when a previous caller was on was, I wonder if the Oregonians' endorsement, based on what Jeff laid out about how the Republican operatives work, it makes you wonder whether or not the Oregonians' endorsement of Saxton for governor was more of an economic endorsement, or whether it was something that actually was truly felt in that organization, because clearly the newspaper makes a lot of money during election seasons by people buying ads and placing ads in the paper, and it appears that was strictly an economic decision and had less to do, because if you saw the Oregonian this morning, the glowing editorial about Kulongowski, mm-hmm, was like, well, gee, haven't you read your own paper the last couple of months? Because it certainly wasn't glowing at that time. But anyway, that was just some of the things that make you go, Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Well, hi. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you, LJ?
I am so good. I'm so happy to be following North Portland Jeff.
Yes, yes, yes. You guys worked that out well, didn't you?
Yes, we did. It was serendipity going on. Okay, listen, here's the deal.
Okay.
I'm cautiously optimistic about what's going to be happening. Okay?
Okay.
There are a couple of things about this election cycle that I found very, very disturbing to me.
Okay.
Mostly how the race card was played.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God, Joanne.
Tennessee is a perfect example of that.
Excuse me?
Tennessee is a perfect example.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Shameful.
That television spot.
Yes.
The way they closed it with the cutesy white blonde,
yes,
saying "Call me sometime."
Yes.
Was just smack in your face racism.
Absolutely.
Pure simple racism.
And so, right? LJ, let me stop you for a second, because maybe most of the listening audience has no clue what we're talking about. So there was an ad that ran almost nonstop on TV in Tennessee. As you know, Representative Ford was running for a seat in the U.S. Congress. Representative Ford is an African-American man running against a white Republican candidate that was in Tennessee, and the TV ads that his opposition put up had this blonde white woman doing this kind of, oh, you know, why don't you call me sometime, big boy kind of thing, that really created this image of, you know, of course, if you elect this black man, he's going to be after all these white women. So, you know, therefore, you really shouldn't elect him. That was the gist of the ad. Okay, LJ.
Okay, now. Afro-Americans being called on the phone.
Yes.
And being told that Dr. King was a Republican.
What?
Yep.
I heard that in Maryland they were passing out pictures of the Republican candidate, mm-hmm, for U.S. Senate.
Mm-hmm.
They were passing out pictures of him standing with Kwasi Fume,
mm-hmm,
and said, really, this guy is really a Democrat. Don't let the R behind his name on the ballot fool you.
right. Yeah,
he's really a Democrat. Yeah, so, I mean, so clearly.
Those calls were absolutely documented.
Yes.
Then, of course, people getting threatening phone calls, predominantly Afro-Americans, in Virginia, who were being told that if they show up at the polls, they will be prosecuted because they're registered in other states.
Oh, in another state. That's right. Or another precinct area.
Another precinct, mm-hmm, right.
I heard that. Did you also hear, I know Latinos were actually getting letters saying that if they didn't have proper documentation, mm-hmm, they were going to be arrested at the poll,
right,
if they showed up.
Right. So it's good to see that the fear tactics instilled by our Republican brothers kind of fell short.
Didn't work this time.
Yeah, and it actually didn't work this time.
Right.
Okay, but there's just two more things.
Okay.
And I'm out of here. Okay, first of all, Bernie Sanders in Vermont, the first openly socialist person ever elected to the Senate.
In Vermont,
65, and he got 65% of the vote.
Wow.
Okay.
That's impressive.
All right. The first Muslim man will be sitting in Congress from Michigan.
I heard about him too. He won.
Yeah. Okay. Now, just one more small thing. Mary Sarrett, who ran on the Constitution Party, got 4% of the vote.
She did.
Right. The Green Party candidate only got 1% of the vote.
Yeah, that's right.
So, anyway, ta-dum-dum.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Keep on keeping on. Dear.
You too. Have Bye-bye. A fabulous day.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
My question is, do people listening or calling, do they think that voters are thinking more internationally these days in terms of this election?
Mm.
That's my question.
Well, I can tell you the feedback from internationally has been quick.
Yes.
And it's been clear.
Yes.
And the rest of the world is celebrating with us this massive change, especially at the congressional level.
Yeah.
And I was actually reading news reports last night from Venezuela and from England and from just all over the place. And the messages were pretty consistent. You know, we're thrilled that the American people got a clue. Right. And I can't even remember who it was. I read some quote that had me cracking up. At least the American people finally woke up, you know. And got rid of these evil people. So the world clearly was paying attention to this election. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting how this election was actually framed in the beginning as, you know, it's just a midterm election, so it's like really not that important. One of the other things that I think was a good lesson for Oregonians was all the ballot measures that were funded by out-of-state interests failed miserably. And so I believe that Oregonians clearly paid attention to who was putting money behind these measures, who were the individuals and organizations behind these measures, and that's why they made such good decisions.
People got tired of Bill Sizemore.
Well, and actually, you know, and I was actually disappointed because the measure, there was one measure.
There was one that he did. And
it
then,
was
yeah,
the insurance
people,
measure.
Yeah, people voted no because of his
people
name.
People voted no because the insurance industry spent over $3 million to paint it as Bill Sizemore.
Right.
And unfortunately, people didn't take the time to read the measure and see that it was really about the basic question of whether or not insurance rates should have anything to do with your credit score.
Right.
And it shouldn't. And I can forgive Oregon voters that one fluke. I can forgive them that one fluke because they did so incredibly well on every other ballot measure. I can't even hold that one against them. So as we're leading up, I'm hopeful that progressives are now thinking about a thoughtful approach to the next legislative session, locally as well as in Congress. I hope that we're not setting up the Democratic Party for failure because, you know, so if anybody thinks that in January we're going to fix the tax system, the health care system, the education system, and in January in Salem or in Congress, you're fooling yourselves. It's going to take a little while. It's going to take some bipartisan work. It's going to take some cooperation around the country to get people all moving in the same direction. But those of us who are community activists and advocates for people that don't have a voice in that system, we still, our job becomes much more important now because now we should have an expectation of moving some of these issues much forward than we've been able to over the last few years. And I know as I was talking to folks who were just recently elected, there's this sense of hope. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what this election has brought back to the American people, this sense of hope, this sense of we're in it together, and together we can figure out a solution.
Yeah.
Hopefully. So I'm giddy. I'm ready. I'm ready to roll up my sleeves and get to work. I'm glad that the election turned out, and I have to say it turned out much better than my expectations were, and I always thought I thought big, but but this election season, it certainly turned out much better than I anticipated, but the cautiously optimistic message I want to leave you with is our work just starts. Now it really starts, and now it becomes really hard because now you're fighting with your friends as well as with the people that you would rather not have coffee with on a regular basis. And Jamila, as always, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
I always love your insight and your ability to really talk from a very personal perspective. And what you bring to the program is not just your youth, but the fact that you're a working adult, you're someone struggling with their own health care expenses, and you actually bring a reality to this program that is very, very much appreciated.
Thank you, Drew.
And so we'll find a way to bring it back on next month sometime for some reason. And for the listening audience, you will be happy to know that Dave Mazza is going to be joining me next week. He's ready to come back, and I'm looking forward to having him. Have a great day. This is Joanne Bowman.
I'm Jamila.
And this has been Voices from the Edge. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
feet high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours on earth. And now when you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah, get up.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 9th, and this is the Thursday Morning Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, Martha Odom, a member of Military Families Speak Out, discusses the long-term effects of deployment to Iraq on soldiers and their family. And at 10 on Chicanismo, Carlos Chavez, presents part two of the Mexican-American War, featuring a historian from the University of Southern California. At 10:30 on Art Focused, host Julie Bernard welcomes Portland artist Brad Adkins. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, hear analysis of the new Democratic leadership in the House. Journalist Robert Perry looks at the life and work of Robert Gates, the Bush nominee for Secretary of Defense. And does Rumsfeld's departure leave him open to prosecution? All that this morning on the Thursday Morning Radio Zine. Before we go on, I'd like to say that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Gazelle Full Circle Resale, now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont, and can be reached at 503-284-4192. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. And now we're going to listen to a little Henri Pousset while we wait for Teresa Mitchell and Press Watch.
is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO, Portland, KBOO 90.7 in Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. The music that you heard prior to this was actually the sound of Rumsfeld once he was informed that he was no longer to hold his post. And we got that on a very special super-secret frequency transmitted here to the air room. I have to say, although I watched it happen, I'm surprised to find that the Republican smoke, fog, and mirror machine failed to throw the elections quite as far as was intended. Perhaps you've heard of some of the irregularities. Of course, if you go to gregpalace.com, which is interestingly not available during Election Day, maybe it's too popular, you can find a description of the usual tricks. And as a matter of fact, Palace article was published before the election and said how the Republicans threw the election past tense. And he referred to the usual game of vote spoilage, of the very extensive voter elimination drive that the anti-democratic Republicans did, and other dirty tricks, and of course, you know, the good old touchscreen machines that reverse votes and are so hackable. But, you know, all those tricks just didn't quite seem to wash. And last information I have is that Webb is in. That means the Democrats control the Senate. And I guess you've heard it all before, but wow, didn't expect that. Here's another example of voting flaws in Sarasota, Florida. According to the Miami Herald, the runner-up in the state attorney general race is questioning whether his race was omitted from some South Florida ballots. Walter Campbell, a Democrat who lost to Republican Bill McCollum, said voters complained to him that neither the attorney general nor the chief financial officer races appeared on their ballots in Broward and Miami-Dade counties. just Broward and Miami-Dade. There were at least 100 reports to me directly, Campbell said. One guy said, I wanted to vote for you, but I couldn't because your name wasn't on the ballot. Well, there's a little bit of a... Oh, they're so clever, those Republicans. Well, anyway, I haven't been able to take phone calls on the show for the longest. There's been too much rolling, and now I want to take phone calls, and so I'll give out the phone number early on. Here it is, 503-231-8187. Got a pencil? 503-231-8187. I'm sure all the vote elimination tactics have taken their toll. I'm sure that the usual game is going forward. And I have few doubts that we have yet to see the full-scale Roe apparatus directed, for example, against Webb's narrow victory in Virginia. Just you wait. So now that a bit of the smoke and fog has cleared, I see much business as usual. I see the damage wrought. Our national priorities, according to the Democrats, are blah, blah, blah. I really don't give a damn about the Democrats' national priorities. I read them in the paper, and sorry, Dems, here's what our national priorities should be if you ask me. If I were queen for a day, it would be stopping global warming. Hello? Did you notice it rained just a hell of a lot the last couple of days here in the Northwest? If you weren't in the Northwest, maybe you've noticed some extreme weather in your area. Well, we've got to stop global warming. For example, we've got to stop the 260 coal-fired power plants under planning or construction. And, you know, before we can stop them, we've got to be talking about them. That means that we have to do something about the monopoly-owned media. Now, lots of you listening have done something about the monopoly-owned media. You joined KBOO. Thank you very much. I know this is my second show after the membership drive, but I'm still impressed that we can do our long and extensive and, well, long membership drives, and we can get our money in little bitty contributions, everything from $20 to $500, and most people pledging like maybe $60 or $80, and it's just amazing and wonderful, and it's democratic. Little d democratic. That's the amazing thing. That's what I really love about volunteering for this radio station, is watching that actually happen. 260 coal-fired power plants, we've got to talk about them, because the monopoly-owned media simply will not. We've got to restrict and reduce automobile usage. Ow! Did I actually say that out loud? Restrict and reduce automobile usage? Yeah. But, you know, it doesn't have to be so painful. I mean, for example, we could take a look at... Uh-oh, here it comes again. We could take a look at land rights. What are land rights? The word land and the word rights in the same sentence? Yeah, land rights. Because if we had land rights, we could be rational about where we live and how far we have to commute. who ordained commuting? Was it God? I don't think it was. We could be launching temporary artificial clouds into orbit. Yeah, I'm not kidding. There are people talking about this. Not in the U.S. much, in Europe. We could be ending the wars, and we've got to reverse fascism. We've got so much work to do. But I'd like to go to the first caller. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Hi, what you got to say? Patrick.
This is Patrick. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question, I guess, about your opinion. After, you know, watching the elections and thinking about how this happened, I was so skeptical. I kept thinking that because of the voting machines being just what they are, I'm just curious about, do you think that the Democrats have found kind of an under the radar way of combating this, and we don't know about it?
Well, I did wonder about that, and I wondered about it aloud during the election night coverage. One thing that I'd be concerned about would be the typical Rovian trick of observing a national zeitgeist, for example, the fact that people are scared of those machines, and then smearing the opposition with it. So it would be handy for Rove if Republican operatives just sort of accidentally suggested to Democratic operatives just how to throw the machines. And so it would be then possible to point to a race here or there and say, look, the Democrats threw the race, and more than that, the, let's see, what did they say, Sequoia's got ties to Hugo Chavez and all the kind of ridiculous crap that they can launch up into a gigantic pile of ridiculous crap on the monopoly on media. You know, it'll go out in the Republican talking points, and, you know, Rush will be talking about it, and Savage will be talking about it, and everybody will be talking about it. Yeah, so I worry about that, but I don't know yet, haven't heard that yet. It's obvious that a lot of touchscreen machines didn't work, and it said that's because people weren't familiar enough with them to boot them up. But, you know, it could be because they were sabotaged, and they could have been sabotaged. They could have been sabotaged simply by people who are interested in democracy and who wanted to force a paper ballot, in which case I congratulate them. I metaphorically shake their hand. Does that answer the question?
It does. It does. Thanks a lot for taking my question.
Thanks for calling. Number to call, 503-231-8187. So much work to do. Do you know how deep we are in right now? I mean, as I was saying, just because the cloud clears doesn't mean the battle is over. I mean, where to start? The Warner Act. Posse comitatus. What is that? Posse comitatus means that the military can't be used against you. Well, it's gone now, folks. It's out of here. The Warner Act. The military tribunals and all that, and the torture act. What was that one called? I forget. But anyway, that reversed habeas corpus. What is habeas corpus? That means... that means rule of law. I mean, that means that you can't be grabbed, for whatever reason, thrown into a wee blet and never seen again. That's just the basis of it. I mean, that's what's done. You don't have rule of law unless you're able to contest and acknowledge your imprisonment. It doesn't matter what charge you're brought in on if you're not able to acknowledge your imprisonment. And the information that you may have heard that the removal of habeas corpus only applies to aliens is wrong, because although it does say aliens at the beginning of the act, deep within the act, it says any person. That would be any person. That would be you, enemy combatant. You know, just from one enemy combatant to another. This is dangerous. The Patriot Act, we knew that was unconstitutional, ridiculous, extensive, secret, absurd, fascist. It has to be repealed. All of these acts have to be repealed, removed. And are the Democrats going to do that without us screaming in the streets? No. So we got some screaming to do. Number to call, 503-231-8187. We've got to dismantle the national security and Heimat apparatus. Excuse me for being obscure. We've got to dismantle the national security and homeland apparatus. And to do that, we have to get at its roots. The roots are fear and ignorance. And I believe that we have a caller. I could be wrong about that. No. Oh, the engineer was using her hair to send signals to me, and I was fooled by that. I also want to talk about Christian mythology and Mr. Haggard and the whole Jesus Camp, not just the movie. I mean, I love the name of that movie, though, Jesus Camp. That works perfectly. I was, you know, when it comes to Haggard and... well, the Republican Queen explosions, I have a special connection for a couple of reasons. One, I'm a transsexual. Who's this guy calling himself Teresa? I'm transgender. I'm also an androgyne. I was also brought up in the South, and I was brought up Baptist. And all of this is very, very familiar to me. And it was because I was brought up Baptist that I so desperately and crazily tried to deny the fact that I'm just a different critter. I am a different critter physically and mentally. from just about anyone you're going to meet. And it took me a long time to confront that. And fortunately, I was not forced to confront it in a super ugly way as Haggard was, although, you know, I feel like probably most of you do that, you know, serves him right. But he was a closet queen. He was trying to deal. He was brought up in a fundamentalist Baptist environment, much as I was. He tried to deny his real identity, much as I did. And I don't know, does that make him bad? It does in effect, but I don't, you know, I'm not one of these persons that believes people are inherently evil anyway, for the most part. I've yet to meet an inherently evil person. I've met people who are so deeply frightened and so deeply angry that they are effectively evil. But, you know, this Haggard character who was head of New Life Church, he was just trying to deal, the way I see it. And he tried to suppress his own individuality. And this is one of the things I hate about fundamentalist and charismatic Christian mythology, is it is soul-killing. And let me explain why I say that. First, let me start off and frame this. The largest religion in the world is Christianity. It rarely gets criticized. If you feel threatened by the fact that I'm about to criticize Christianity, you're not paying attention to the fact that you guys are on top. And you have nothing to fear from my criticism. It cannot amount to intimidation. Therefore, I don't want to get a call saying that I am preventing you from exercising your religion, or that I am intimidating you, as some Christian demagogues will say, because it can't be done from here, and I wouldn't want it ever to happen. But the view of the charismatic evangelical Christians predicate their worldview on a mythology. A mythology, frankly, and I want you to look up some of these terms, is based on an amalgamation that was put together by Emperor Constantine and elements around him in the 4th century AD. It consists of elements of the Zoroaster myth. That would be the three kings. Remember the three kings, the three magi? They visited Zoroaster because he was a Persian demigod. And they got applied to Jesus. Now, why would these Persian mystics be going to see Jesus when he was born? Because it legitimized him. This is the sort of thing that was done to make religion more palatable. It was just applied to the story of Yeshua ben Miriam, or Jesus, if you like. It is an amalgamation of ideas from Mithra. Mithra was born of a virgin and offered salvation from eternal damnation. There are many other, not just similarities, frankly. Mithra is where a lot of the mythology applied to the Jesus character came from. The Jesus character himself is conflated with John the Baptist, the actions of Yeshua ben Miriam himself, the attitudes of Krishna and Buddha followers, and with Bar Kochva, who is all three of those. John the Baptist, Jesus, and Bar Kochva were anti-Roman Jewish revolutionaries. Finally, in Constantine's court, it was very handy to pick up the idea of the Christus, the Christ, because the Cairo cult, you know, that X and P that you see in Christian heraldry, did not come from what you were told. It came from the Cairo cult. Those are the letters Chi and Rho. And that was very much part of the Roman military. The military aspect of a rejectionist punishing religion was very appealing to Constantine, so he combined the Cairo cults, the Sol Invictus cults, that means unconquered sun, that's why you have December 25th, that and the fact that it was Mithra's unconquered sun day, has the Christian holiday. All of this was mixed together, and you get a mythology, and from that mythology, you get, frankly, genocidal America. I would like to thank my coffee bringer, bringing me a cup that says, "Hi, Daddy." That is so nice, with hot coffee in it. Very, very good in this time of sniffles. Anyway, you take all this mythology together, bring it forward into the 21st century, and add all of the guilt, the dodging, the machinations, the ignorance, and the craziness of modern America. And you get this character who, on the one hand, offers you love and acceptance, and on the other hand, is going to roast you forever, is going to treat you worse than Jeffrey Dahmer treated his tortured victims if you cross him. Crazy. And this character in the charismatic and evangelical movements hates gays. Why? Well, because it says so in the Bible. Not really. It says to, you know, it says to do away with people who eat shrimp, who wear clothing that mixes fibers, who eat clams. All these things have a prohibition against them somewhere in the Bible. Also, St. Paul didn't like gays, but then there's some speculation that St. Paul was gay. So now that I've kicked all the dents that I can in Christianity, I want to say that the haggard followers, the Jesus camp, we're going to have to deal with that level of denial and that level of craziness on an individual level, and we're going to have to get people to talking about their beliefs before we can move forward rationally and democratically to create a state that allows some transparency, some public participation, in other words, democracy. So that's what I have to say about that. The number to call is still 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. They hate our freedom. Remember that freeze? That phrase, the freezing phrase. Who are they and why do they hate our freedom, right? Well, that was the line that we were sold after another mythological event, the destruction of the World Trade Towers and a chunk of the Pentagon by what we can now see was a pretty well-planned Reichstag-style event. But the phrase is turned around in an article by Aaron Sussman in dissonantvoice.org, which I would recommend that you read, and I would like to share part of it with you. And you can interrupt me. The number to call, 503-231-8187. The truth about the Military Commissions Act. On October 17th, with Dick Cheney, Alberto Gonzalez, and Donald Rumsfeld standing behind him, George W. Bush solemnly announced, "In memory of the victims of September 11th, it is my honor to sign the Military Commissions Act of 2006 into law." It is apt that Bush invoked a terrifying assault on America as he signed the Military Commissions Act. Legislation that chisels away at our civil liberties, abets and immunizes top-level torturers, and strikes at the core of American values and tradition. The message that Bush gave when he signed the defense bill in 2005 is now truer than ever. Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. We never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we. They never stop. In memory of the victims of September 11th, Bush passed a law that Robin Blumner of the St. Petersburg Times calls an obscenity against liberty and decency, and that the executive director of the ACLU calls unconstitutional and un-American, a fitting tribute indeed for the victims whose names have been manipulated by this administration to justify everything from invading Iraq to the USA Patriot Act to torture to tax cuts. This honor to the victims of September 11th is a national disgrace for which the Bush administration, both houses of Congress, and the media are to blame. And I would like to stop there and say, yeah, it was both houses of Congress, wasn't it? And so we put the Democrats in power. What does that mean? We've seen what Democrats have done in collaboration with Republicans for years now, particularly the last 6 years. We saw, for example, Al Gore, bless him, possibly trying to do the right thing, but remember Fahrenheit 9/11 and the video of Al Gore standing there in his role of as president of the Senate, as the vice president is now. Vice President Cheney is president of the Senate. Al Gore was when the election was thrown in 2000. And he was denying the Congressional Black Caucus their every effort to restore actual vote-counting democracy into the proceedings, their effort to get the Senate to do something about the thrown elections. It was sickening. And it set the tone. You know, I like to think that Gore is a tad different now. He's learned some things. He does seem different. But that's what he did, and it set the tone for Democratic collaboration. And it seems that they did much of their collaboration on an intimidated basis, but let's face it, even if you're second in line to the gravy train, you're still on the gravy train. And the Democrats have been okay with that so far. So what changes when they get control? And they've been kicked around for a long time. And, you know, getting a one-seat majority on the Senate is not exactly a mandate. And they certainly, you know, you often hear that the Democrats don't have an agenda. Now, that's not true. What they don't have is control of the corporate-owned media. The 90 corporations, for example, that are currently boycotting Air America in an effort to destroy it, boycotting Air America, even though they could be making huge profits because Air America is stomping the usual right-wing pundits all across the country. Wherever they open up a frequency, they're beating Limbaugh, they're beating Savage, they're beating all of those commentators. But 90 corporations fear them so greatly, because they do occasionally criticize corporations. They are so feared that they are launching a boycott. They're throwing away, and we see this time and again with large capitalist organizations, they throw away, well, even small ones. Profits, the main motivator, right? But really, control is the main motivator. Can't have control of what Air America says, so they want to stomp it. They want to make it go away. We'll see if they survive. KBOO will survive because we get tiny little contributions from you. Thank you very much. So what are the Democrats going to do? I think it depends a lot on what message they get from you and I. And that's why I say now the real work starts. Now the popular will must be expressed. I think that the Internet is having a stronger and stronger effect simply because an informed population is a stronger population. And also, it's becoming easier to organize public demonstrations and public actions through the Internet. So I have some hope, but I also see that there is a vast mountain to be climbed before we can kick down fascism, stop the wars, and reverse global warming. And we have someone on the air, I believe. Leroy? Hi, you on the air? Hello. When you turn up your radio and try to listen to it, what you get is the delay loop. And so I'll just wait a second, and hopefully this also will be a demonstration to everyone who calls this show and every other show on KBOO that if you listen to the radio, you'll get confused. Are you there, Leroy? Hello, Leroy. This reminds me of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant, saying, "We'll just wait for it to come around on the guitar again. I'm not tired." No, let's see. The first thing he says is, "I'm not proud or tired, but I am running out of time, so this is your last chance. Leroy, are you there?" Okay, never mind, Leroy. Number call, 503-231-8187. If you're extremely fast, you can get in on the last call in the last minute. One of the many, many dubious clauses in the Act that I was just referring to, the most egregious is the one that eliminates the writ of habeas corpus, the right to challenge the legality of one's imprisonment, a fundamental right that dates back to the Magna Carta. And to depart from the text, we're talking about the 13th century Magna Carta. Hey, King John, you can't throw us in a weeblet. In his first inaugural address in 1801, Thomas Jefferson said, "Freedom of the person under protection of the habeas corpus I deem one of the essential principles of our government." Ironically, the Supreme Court case Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, remember that, which held that Bush's original military tribunals were illegal and made the congressionally approved MCA Act necessary, would never have occurred if the MCA had been in effect, as it was petitioned by a detainee. According to the MCA, no court, justice, or judge shall have jurisdiction to hear or consider an application for a writ of habeas corpus, yep, that's what it says, filed by or on behalf of an alien detained by the United States who has been determined by the U.S. to have been properly detained as an enemy combatant or is awaiting such determination. And it is that initial language, here again departing from the text, that makes the press say so glibly, well, we're just talking about aliens here. It's further down in the Act that says that the president may seize any person who aids, abets, or blah, blah, in this hokey determination of who's an enemy combatant. That means you're an enemy combatant. That means I'm an enemy combatant. And so as a information terrorist, an enemy combatant against fascism, it's my time to sign off. And thank you for listening to Press Watch. Stay tuned for more of the Incomparable Radio Zine. And remember, at 11 o'clock, Democracy Now!
And that concludes Press Watch. Stay tuned now as Martha Odom, a member of Military Families Speak Out, discusses the long-term effects of deployment to Iraq on soldiers and their families. She speaks with Adele Kubain. Stay tuned for that.
Good morning. This is Martha Odom for KBOO Radio. An announcement for you before we go to our interview. Elizabeth Attlee of Portland is presenting tonight her New Orleans documentary, Left to Die, the Causeway Concentration Camp, New Orleans, USA, 2005. It will be shown at the Clinton Street Theater tonight, Thursday, at 7 p.m., and at the Baghdad Theater. It will show for 3 nights, Monday through Wednesday, November 13th to the 15th, time to be announced. It is an important movie, a documentary that everyone should see, and we can't forget New Orleans. So, now we'd like to go to our interview for today, Adele Cobain, member of Military Families Speak Out Oregon. Adele, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Thank you for being with us. And Military Families Speak Out, can you tell me a little bit about what the organization is, how it started?
And sure. Military Families Speak Out started in November of 2002, and it was founded by Nancy Lesson, Charlie Richardson, and Jeffrey McKenzie, who met at a demonstration trying to head off the war. They had children in the military, and I think it started a couple of months before that, because by November of 2002, there were 200 members, and I was one of the first members. We lobby with our representatives, we demonstrate in Washington, we speak with the press, we engage in a variety of different activities to try to bring awareness to the cost of the war, not only to us personally, but also to the nation of Iraq.
Adele, your personal stake in Military Families. I know this is probably a little bit hard, but maybe you've gotten used to talking about it. Your daughter is a wounded Iraqi vet.
Yes, my daughter was in Iraq for 10 months, and she was injured. She was kept in combat for 2 months with a shattered leg. She was eventually medically evacuated, and she is disabled now. She will actually never be able to do any of the things that she used to do, and currently she is without a job. So she's a disabled Iraq vet who was just released from her job, and she has a young child, and she's trying to find a way to survive with disability and post-traumatic stress.
She was kept there for 2 months with a shattered leg?
Yes, she was needed. Her unit needed her. She was a 50 caliber gunner and a field mechanic, and nobody would send her to the hospital. And finally, another officer saw her limping and had her sent for an exam, and that's when she was medically evacuated.
So this 2 months must have added to the injuries. So
yes, her leg is not repairable any longer.
So she has had dealings, obviously, then with the Veterans Administration. Are they being cooperative and supportive?
Well, I think that within their bounds, they're being as supportive as possible. But for one, the Veterans Administration is terribly overworked. And she, as yet, her case has not been decided yet. She's not getting any disability. Actually, as of this week, she's not getting any income whatsoever. And there was no plan in place for the National Guard's troops who were injured. There was sort of an attitude at the beginning of the war and the occupation that they just didn't need anything for the National Guard troops. And even though over 40% of the troops in Iraq were National Guard. So when they returned injured, pretty much in the beginning, after the first 90 days, they just wanted to discharge them out onto the streets. And we really had to fight for the right to get them treated as other service people. I mean, they went there, they got injured. Many of them have been killed. Many of them are disabled. And yet they've had to fight just to be treated as other soldiers would be treated.
So there's actually a difference in if you are a regular military or National Guard to what benefits you are entitled
Correct.
To?
Correct. National Guard troops don't have medical insurance. After 90 days after their return into the United States, they are put back in a sort of a National Guard status, which means that they don't have access to Veterans Administration facilities or anything like that. And we've really worked hard to change that. Our representative, Peter DeFazio, took a letter to Congress for us, and this helped my daughter at the time and many other Oregon National Guard troops.
I think of myself as being pretty informed about this kind of thing, but quite honestly, until this moment, I had no idea that the National Guard people, who are deployed as though they are regular Army, just simply have no benefits when they come back. Is this a priority for Military Families Speak Out? Because there are tremendous numbers of National Guard taken there.
Our main priority is to get the troops home now. We don't believe in a phased withdrawal. We think that that will put the troops who are left there in even more danger. And we have a continued mandate to take care of them when they get home. And we know that we will be fighting that battle for a while. There is virtually no counseling available for post-traumatic stress victims, both regular Army and Guard and Reserve units. As I said, the Veterans Administration is way overloaded. So this is going to be a battle for a long time. The American people allowed the troops to be sent there, and they really need to make that effort to lobby for them when they get home. They just don't realize that Veterans Administration cuts are happening all of the time.
Someone in the past few days pointed out to me that we are not seeing photographs, partly because it was not permitted to show photographs of flag-draped coffins coming back, but we are not seeing disabled vet photographs in the media. Once upon a time, disabled vets were paraded around as great heroes, and in this war especially, it seems that they're being tucked away out of sight, that we don't want to see it. We don't want to make people upset or unhappy or distract them from shopping.
Well, many of the disabled vets are still in Walter Reed. Veteran Acosta, I think his first name is Joe, is in the Ground Truth. I think that it's very hard for our vets to, they really need to believe that what they're doing is the right thing. Nobody wants to go and lose a limb and then come home and have to think, hey, this war was based on lies and misdirection. You just don't want to think that. So I think that nobody wants to go out and say, hey, look at what happened to me because I've been led astray. I think so nobody wants to be looked at that way, and I think that that's one of the reasons. The United States at this point is coming to a realization, at least 57% of American citizens realize that the war had no foundation in truth. And so it's very hard. What do you say to your veteran who lives next to you who comes home missing a limb? Do you say, I'm sorry? And I think that this is a wound in the psyche of America that's going to have to be addressed.
I have been very impressed with the returning Iraqi vets who are speaking out and organizing and working to help other vets. Do you have experience of that?
Well, I have an experience from Crawford, Texas. There's a place there called the Peace House. And one night while I was in Texas and Crawford, in the middle of the night, a van pulled up to the Peace House. And a young person came in and said, I have somebody in the van who needs some help. And so there are veterans at the Peace House at all times. And one of the veterans went out there, and it was a young man who had lost part of his arm and a leg, and he'd been terribly disfigured. His face was pretty much blown off. And he came in the middle of the night, and he sat with the veterans at the Peace House, and he said, I won't even go out during the day because I'm a monster now.
He said, I don't want anybody to see me. And he said, but I need to talk to people. And he started coming to the Peace House at night and sitting with the other vets and talking and stuff. And this was his only connection with human beings at this point. And I think that the veterans are very supportive of each other. The Veterans for Peace, who were Vietnam veterans, embrace the new veterans who are coming, and Iraq Veterans Against the War is starting to gain some momentum. The difference between this and the Vietnam War is that there is not a draft now. And so the veterans and the people who are in the service now volunteered, and their livelihoods and their families depend upon that service. They volunteered because they were committed, and they didn't get sent because they didn't get sent where they didn't want to be. So there's a different kind of movement now with the veterans than there was during the Vietnam era. They're not coming back and saying, hey, you know, we got drafted and we didn't want to be there. This is a different type of veteran, a committed veteran who enlisted to serve their nation. And I think some of them are feeling very betrayed at this point because they realize that the war and the occupation are based on misdirection. And they are starting to speak out, but their families depend on them for their livelihoods. And so there's a lot of pressure not to speak out and not to do anything.
Very hard. My family and first war experience is Vietnam, and I certainly have heard from Vietnam vets, what now, 35 years later, this ambiguity about wanting to serve, wanting to help your country, and even in Vietnam, knowing it wasn't a legitimate war, the internal conflict, the sense of not being appreciated for your service, has to be extremely psychologically, emotionally painful.
Well, I think that we really strive to make sure that the troops know that we appreciate their service. We don't blame them for what the administration has done. And I think it's very good, it's wonderful that this is a different nation, and we learned a lot from Vietnam. And I don't think that the troops are ever disrespected. I've never heard of a case of that. I mean, it probably happens, but anybody who would do that would be of the utmost ignorance. We really strive to point out that we support the troops, but we do not support the occupation of Iraq. And supporting the troops means to call for their return at once.
At once. Another Vietnam sort of parallel is our own troops participating or being complicit in war atrocities. I know we bring from Vietnam the My Lai massacre memory, horror, scar on our souls, and...
Well, there is no just war. And all wars create atrocities, all of them. Whenever you put a bunch of people under stress, you have young people, they are taught to kill, that's what it's all about. They are put into a stressful situation, they are told that everybody is the enemy except for the people around them. And that is how atrocities happen. There is the people who are really responsible for those atrocities are in the White House and in the Pentagon, because they have put our troops in a situation that they cannot control. There are not enough troops there. There shouldn't be any troops there. Any time that you create this type of situation where you are in a civilian population and the troops do not know where attacks are going to come from, and they become angry, they have post-traumatic stress, and then atrocities happen.
Not too recent, but reputable Harvard study documented that approximately 1 out of 10 people returning from a combat situation. Any combat situation will exhibit psychological damage sufficient to require treatment. Sufficient to require treatment is a harsh phrase, and that obviously means that psychological damage less than needing treatment occurs. And the returning Iraqi vets that I've had personal encounters with seem to be carrying an incredible burden of grief, stress, conflict. I think the problem is that when you have internal directions to go two opposite directions and both are equally compelling, that it sets up a dynamic where something has to break.
Well, yes, we are really just barely starting to see the effects of the war on the psyche of the returning troops. There have been a few cases in the news here and there about some terrible things happening. I have two friends whose sons killed themselves after return, and there are a number of suicides. There are also a number of suicides in the field in Iraq which don't get claimed as suicides. They're called the non-hostile gun incidents or something like that. And I think that this is something that we need to be prepared to deal with in the long run. Troops come back, they've been under constant stress for, you know, a minimum a year at a time, and sometimes up to four deployments. When they drive, they are freaked out by things on the side of the road. They have to deal with anger issues. When you are have to constantly be on alert and anything is a threat, it's very hard to return and go grocery shopping in a store. It's hard to drive. It's hard to deal with when you left, you were one person and you thought that you were going to help people and so on. You come home, you've been away from your wife at a minimum a year or your husband. You come back, you've been in such a different world that they just have no idea. We have no idea of what it's like for the troops there. And really, counseling and so on are of paramount importance at this point. The Army just tends to medicate, and that just puts it off. When you are wandering around in a fog of medication, you really don't have a chance to deal very much with the things that you need to. There is a there's a group of counselors, and they have something called the Returning Veterans Resource Project Northwest. And their phone number is 503-402-1717.
Adele, would you give
of counselors?
Would you give me that number one more time, and we will have it at the front desk at KBOO?
Okay, it is 503-402-1717. And these counselors have committed. Each one of them will take one service person and their family. And they are offering free and confidential counseling to veterans and their families who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. This is a committed group of people who is in it for the long run.
That is wonderful. This is Martha Odom at KBOO. We are speaking with Adele Kubain of Military Families Speak Out Oregon. Adele, on Saturday, are showing the premiere of Military Families Speak Out Oregon. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Certainly. We got a grant from the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation, which is a social change organization, and we used a part of that to create a documentary of Oregon military families who and some of us have lost our loved ones in the occupation and war, and some of us are, so there are a number of MFSO families in this documentary, and we are having a premiere at the Hollywood Theater on Sandy Boulevard on Saturday at 1 p.m.
And this is open to the public, and we've gotten some reviews in Willamette Weekly on the documentary and so on. And we created this to create awareness of the cost of war, and we would like to spread this video as widely as possible because we think that coming from our very own voices is probably the very best way for people to understand this war on a personal basis. Since there aren't so many troops in Iraq, only 150,000 compared to past wars, there are only so many families who really understand what this war cost. So we think that our voices can help raise awareness in the rest of the country.
Following the movie, you will have a discussion panel session?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We will take, Tom Hartman's partner on the radio, and oh, I apologize to her.
Heidi Chauber.
That's it. I don't have her name in front of me right now. She will be the MC for the event, and then she will open a, people will be able to ask us questions and speak with us. So that way we can answer any questions that come up in the film directly to the public.
This is an important thing to know about. It is hard to grasp the effect not just on one single returning vet for a short term, but a lifetime, and on the people, the families around, the implications for a wounded PTSD victim or a casualty of the war is not one moment in time, but goes on. My loved one from Vietnam, it's 35 years, and the pain has never gone away. 35 years, and I wasn't even there, and it still hurts.
Well, as a community, we need to embrace our veterans and help them in every way that we can. I think that the more we become aware of the problems that they face, the better a job that we can do. Within certain indigenous communities, when somebody returns from war, there are rituals and there are ways for the community to re-embrace that member. I think that we need to find the ways to re-embrace our returning veterans, because we cannot isolate them and we can't isolate ourselves from the responsibility for them.
And in many ways it spills out into the wider community.
Yes.
The problems of domestic violence, the problems of homelessness, there's so many facets of this that spill out into the community. They're not isolated into our own individual families.
Well, I think on a broader level, I think once we become aware that each person is responsible for the other people around them, that is what creates a society. We cannot just look at homeless vets or any homeless people and say that this is not my responsibility. We reap the benefits of the society that we live in. And so we have to reach out and extend those benefits to the rest of our members.
Okay, before I ask you again to tell us about the movie on Saturday, I would like to add that our local Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 is inviting folks to join them on Saturday. They are liking to refer to it as Armistice Day instead of Veterans Day. The original intent was to celebrate peace, the ending of war. They will be at Pioneer Square. Taps will be sounded at 11:11 a.m. in memory of war fallen. And following that, there will be speakers sharing feelings, memories, hopes, prayers, and the public is urged, invited to attend. I was with them last year. It was very moving.